Thank you. The subject of this afternoon's second panel is redistricting, and we have three speakers. The format is slightly different from what it was this morning. Sam Zakharoff, who will go first, will speak for roughly 15 minutes. Guy Charles, who will go second and also has a, I hesitate to use the word major paper because it suggests that some people have minor papers, but he will also speak for 15 minutes, and then Ellen Katz, who has both a major slash minor paper and comments on others, will speak for as long as she wants, up to 15 minutes. Okay, Sam.
Make this up as I go along.
So,
do you want me to go first?
We should go first.
Thank you. I would like to make it up.
What's up to you?
I guess I'll talk until Sam wants to stop me, which he's more than welcome to. So let me just thank Ned and the symposium organizers. It's been fabulous to be here, and I appreciate the ability to come. So thank you for inviting me. So what I wanted to talk about in the paper, only Rick Hasson has read this paper, by the way. So if you have any questions about it, you should ask him. What I want to talk about the paper is to explore the contours of the concept of racial representation, or racial representational rights, sort of in the new parlance of the court, of voters of color, in particular following LULAC. Are we on? Okay. Following LULAC, but more generally seeing LULAC as the most recent instance of vote dilution cases that essentially had their genesis in Thornburg versus Jingles, where the court starts thinking about the role of vote dilution, particularly in this case, in LULAC, as it applies to politics. There are three essential points that the paper makes, but I'll focus on one, but let me just run down the three essential points right now. First, I want to argue that LULAC is really not a racial case or a racial vote dilution case, but a political vote dilution case masquerading as a race case. That when you go through the facts and you look at the logic, that it's hard to take this case seriously as a race case. And I think, from my perspective anyway, it's the clearest example to date of the court using race to check politics, and that's the best explanation for the case, and that's probably where I'll spend the bulk of my 15 minutes today. Second, I also want to take the opportunity to contextualize what I think is a long history on the court of trying to determine the appropriate boundary or relationship between race and politics, and LULAC is the latest example of the saga in that narrative, but I won't talk about much about that today except in the Q&A if we want to. And then third, I want to explore the likelihood of success of this attempt of using race to check politics, this instrumental use of race, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing for voters of color. And I'll briefly make some comments about that at the end. And my point will be that I think it's a bad thing, both on doctrinal grounds and on practical grounds. And the doctrinal grounds essentially are that I think there are some doctrinal moves that or tensions that are papered over by what the court does here. And on practical grounds, I'll contrast Justice Kennedy's approach with what I think is Chief Justice Roberts' approach. And my intuition is that the Roberts approach would probably be better off for voters of color. And I'll just say a few words about that before I close. So let's start with the question, is this case a race case, or is this case a case that is about politics? Now, I think there's a tendency, anyway, that attempting to view LULAC as a racial vote dilution case And particularly as the case that if it doesn't celebrate the idea of racial representation, at least it recognizes its importance. And I think there is something to be said for that tendency. As a point of departure, I don't think Lulac is an anti-essentialism case. That is where the court says the concept of racial representation is something that we must extinguish in the ways, and I'll draw some comparison to the early Shaw cases. And so definitely not a case in the mold of Shaw versus Miller. There are some differences in this case that I think are worth pointing out. So if you'll recall, in the early Shaw cases, the court was horrified by the use of race, right? I mean, there was this picture that the court painted for us, and it was not simply the manner in which race was used, which was important, but the fact that race was used, right, in the political process horrified the courts. And when you look at the language of the court used in Shaw and Miller and the subsequent cases, you could see the tenor of the opinions and the court's horror reflected in the opinion. The court failed to acknowledge in these important cases arising from North Carolina, from Georgia, from Texas, etc., cases with long histories of racial discrimination, cases where vote dilution has a very long history, cases of racially polarized voting. The court barely, if at all, acknowledged the history of racial discrimination, the vote dilution, etc., and the court didn't pay any attention to that and focus specifically on how race is so polarizing and move to what I call the anti-essentialism principle. So in the Shaw cases, the court could have also, found that the use of race has constitutional dimensions, right? So the court didn't simply limit its analysis to a statutory analysis, to the Voting Rights Act, either Section 2 or the importance of Section 5 or the Justice Department's role there. The court went on and talked about how the use of race in those cases strongly implicates the Constitution, and in some senses the overlap between the statutory analysis and the constitutional analysis was fairly close. So, for example, in Shaw versus Miller, the court's analysis is not limited to its understanding of what the VRA requires with respect to racial representation. Rather, the court jumps relatively fast to underscore the constitutional dimensions and implications of linking race with politics. So, in sum, the anti-essentialism principle in those cases is used to really undermine the very concept, the very idea of racial representation. Now, a contrast must be drawn with those cases with what the court is doing, what Justice Kennedy in particular, I think, does in Lulac. By contrast, you can detect, at least I would argue that you can detect, a more sophisticated and subtle a reaction to the use of race, right? There isn't apartheid type language that you see in the cases. The level of stylistic construction and tone. I mean, I note in the introduction that you have the use of the term Latino voting power, right, and the non-awkward uses of those terms. There isn't the horror that you saw in the Shaw cases. And here in Lulac, the court appreciates the history of discrimination, the vote dilution, especially, of course, as it applies to District 2023. And Justice Kennedy's reaction, I think, is a bit more subdued and comfortable with the concept of racial representation, although not altogether buying into the whole concept, right, but much more comfortable if you compare his opinion in Lulac with his opinion in Miller, much more comfortable, I think, with the concept of representation and commenting on how race is being deployed, sometimes for good, sometimes for ill, but in his discussion of District 23, takes cognizance of the history, of the vote dilution, et cetera. Yes, Justice Kennedy talks about racial essentialism, right? But unlike the Shaw cases, where the anti-essentialism principle is used to undermine the concept of racial representation itself, that is not the case in Lulac. In Lulac, the anti-essentialism principle is used not to strike down a district, but but to show, to uphold a racialized district, right? And I think that's an important distinction. And fairly quickly on two doctrinal distinctions that are worth noting. Also in LULAC, you don't see the court dwelling upon the constitutional dimensions of anti-essentialism, right? You can scour the opinion, especially the discussion of District 25, right, where the court doesn't say, well, if the use of race here implicates the Constitution, and if we were to use race in this way, that would undermine the Voting Rights Act, et cetera. Secondly, and in fact, when you look at how the court uses and thinks about Section 2, Justice Kennedy explicitly says in a discussion of District 25, compactness is not required by Section 2, although he goes on and talks about the role that compactness can play. So even with respect to the statutory interpretation, right, the anti-essentialism principle does not strike its head and strike everything down as to the statutory level nor to the constitutional level. So in my view, Justice Kennedy's discussion in LULAC is remarkable precisely because the anti-essentialism discussion avoids the urge to think about these issues in constitutional terms. Okay, so I think it's hard to conclude that this case is not different from the Shaw cases in terms of how the court thinks about racial essentialism. But I also think it's a mistake to view this case as a case that celebrates racial representation. And in fact, when I conclude, I'll note that I think it may lead in the other direction. So I think there is a temptation to view LULAC as a case that is about vote dilution, racial vote dilution, that celebrates racial representation. And let me highlight a couple reasons why I think that would be the wrong way of looking at this case. First of all, you have an opinion that allows the dismantling of District 24, an African-American coalitional or influence district, depending upon how you read the facts. And it is hard, I think, to distinguish why Justice Kennedy finds District 23, all right, very quick, why Justice Kennedy finds District 23 to present such compelling facts, right, but to find that the African-American district to be much less compelling, even on the doctrinal terms, and we could talk about that later. Justice Kennedy says, well, you know, the African-American voters in District 24, it was not a competitive district, and it's hard to tell who their preference would have been, given the lack of competition, especially, particularly, at the primary level. Now, there might be something to be said for that. That is, in the abstract, one might say, well, perhaps African-American voters would have preferred an African-American representative as opposed to the white representative that they, in fact, had and for whom the district was drawn, right? But these cases are never about, in the abstract, what one would have preferred, right? Do you want Cynthia McKinney or do you want Jetty, or do you want some, you know, another black person that is not quite as out there, or a conservative black, et cetera? That's not really what the cases are about. What the cases are often about are, given the contextual facts, right, what are the preferences? And here, Justice Kennedy adds a projection, right, what would they have wanted in almost an idealized sense that is not consistent with the doctrine. So it's hard, I think, to distinguish why he treats one district similarly one way and treats another one dissimilarly. Moreover, I think when you look at the distinction that Justice Kennedy reaches in his discussion, for example, of the Latino district, I also think that it's very hard to understand what the differences are there. Right? As the Chief Justice says, well, so you have two far-flung districts. Okay, there are two far-flung districts. Why do you think one is much more so than the other? Yes, one is closer to the, you know, one group is closer to the Mexican border, but when you take District 23 and you look at the geography, it's very hard to understand what the differences are. And Justice Kennedy says, well, it's not just, you know, the fact that you have two Latinos in the geography, it's compactness, etc. No matter how you slice the distinctions that he tries to make, I don't think they're persuasive on their own terms. So if this case were really about racial vote dilution and race representation, then you ought to treat at least those districts fairly similarly. Okay, so what is this case about? And I think I have about 2.5 minutes to tell you that. Oh, good. Okay, I have 10. So what is this case about? the argument here is that the court is using the racial vote dilution case here to limit partisan gerrymandering. When you think about what Justice Kennedy, the way that Justice Kennedy thinks about these issues, one of the things that we could say about the partisan gerrymander in Texas is that at the very least we know that the partisan gerrymander was facilitated. It's definitely helped. Doesn't mean that it was a necessary event, but it was definitely facilitated by the ability to gerrymander District 23, supplement with District 25, right, and allow allow the Republicans to have a better hand than they would otherwise have. Right, so there's an important constraining role that is played by limiting, and this is where I think the crucial part of Justice Kennedy's opinion here is, by limiting the ability to gerrymander District 23, right, and doing away with the argument, the necessary argument, that, well, we made up for it elsewhere. And I think And when you look at the political science literature here, too, I think it's very, very useful that as much constraints as you can impose on redistrictors, you limit their ability to engage in extreme partisan line drawing. Right? And if the goal here is to limit extreme partisan line drawing, then limiting the ability to move racial districts, especially where you impose strong limitations that says, well, if you have a racialized district, Pillis is calling naturally occurring. I don't know if this is your term, Rick, but it was in your paper. Naturally occurring racialized district. Then Justice Kennedy is making it very difficult for the states to move those districts. In some senses, one of the things that came to mind when I was reading the opinion is whether District 23 is an actual thing. Right, you read the opinion, Justice Kennedy wants to say, well, there's such a thing as District 23. Well, it is not an actual thing, right? It goes from here and it's been there historically, but he wants to anchor it in a particular geography. And I think it's that anchoring, right, that provides the limiting, effectual limiting principle, and makes it harder for redistrictors, in this particular case anyway, to engage, to have the degrees of freedom that they would need to engage in extreme partisan line drawing. Let me just say one word about why I think Chief Justice Roberts' approach would have been better for voters of color. I think what Justice Kennedy ends up doing is he establishes a fairly a floor that protects voters of color when there are existing racialized districts, right? Whether you want to call them Section 2 districts or not, but I'm calling them racialized districts. But he also provides a fairly low ceiling that limits the ability of the state to, and limits the ability of voters of color to bargain for districts that can't be strictly justified on either VRA grounds or on constitutional grounds. Right. Whereas the Chief Justice, even with the remark, the sordid business divvying us by race, I think wants to say, look, this thing is ugly, nasty, and brutish, and the best way to deal with it is to limit the court's involvement as much as possible. My guess is that his approach would not have been as protective for voters of color, but would have enabled them to engage in bargaining that would not be supervised by the courts. I think Justice Kennedy has a strong supervisory role that he imposes, which limits the bargaining ability of voters of color. My sense is that the Chief Justice is more anything, this is a knife fight and almost anything goes approach. And I think that comment was meant to reflect the fact that politics and race is a dirty business. And if you involve the courts in strictly regulating what states can do, then you also, in some senses, undermining constitutional doctrine by bringing it down into the muck. So my view and the argument here is that I think voters of color would have been better off having a structure that is much wider open, where they have to defend themselves but are not going to be protected by the court, than having a structure where there's some protection for the court but imposes a fairly low ceiling on bargaining in their best interest. So let me stop there and move it on to others. Thank you.
And so the presentation I'm going to give is really about what is the nature of the harm. And the suggestion is going to be that the court hasn't figured that out. And in part, it hasn't figured out the partisan gerrymandering context because it thinks it's about partisan gerrymandering, which it understands to be either the Democrats or Republicans coming to the court and saying, in one state, one time, we got screwed by the other party. And the court does not have a systemic account of what the system of politicized redistricting is doing to the overall competitiveness of the political process. So this paper is just data, and it's, since it's just data, but for the conventions in law, the names would be reversed, and mine would appear as an asterisk. This is heavily the work of Jonathan Nagler of the Political Science Department at NLE. Okay, let me give it. This is from a piece by Sam Hirsch a couple of years ago. And basically, what this shows is if you look at what happens after reapportionment in the period after Baker and Reynolds, you find that you have a baseline of about a 95% reelection rate for incumbents in Congress. After redistricting, it drops to about 91%, so you get a shakeup effect as you would hope for, and that 2002, first post-2000 redistricting, is somewhat aberrant because instead of it going down, it goes up, and redistricting is an occasion for less turnover in Congress than we normally have. So that's gives a hint that something is changing. This is another way the data are incomplete here. This is the Congressional Quarterly, and this is how they rate the elections beforehand. And you can see basically that over time, the column that's either competitive or really competitive has been virtually a disappearing entity and gets smaller and smaller. So we all know the data by 2004, you got four people voted out. This is another way of depicting the Congressional Quarterly predictions with after the election data. This is kind of an awkward thing, but the bottom line is the districts that are decided by less than 5% between the Democrats and Republicans, and the top line, the top line over here is the districts that are decided by 10% between the Democrats and Republicans in the election, and what you see if you trace this is it's generally a cyclical decline, and to the point that if we were to run this into 2004, we would not only go off the chart on the right-hand side, but on the bottom also, effectively. Competitive elections are disappearing for Congress. This is something that some of you saw a couple of years ago. I'll just put up, we did a tightening study of all the states that were the break, make or break states in 2004, the ones where the elections were close. And so these are states that are roughly 50-50 states. And what one finds is in Arkansas, you have four of the five districts contested for redistricting, after redistricting. Well, it's not four of us. It's five out of six, and it goes down to four out of six, or three out of six, something like that. I forget exactly. But you see that the trend is down. It should be more contested elections after redistricting if they're up for grabs. And what one finds is that after redistricting, this is comparing 2000 to 2002, after redistricting, margin of victories increase both in the contested elections and then overwhelmingly And the data, I know that there's some contested issues in political science, but the data basically support this. So here's where our work starts, and that's the background. That's my way of saying, court, be careful, because what you've seen is only the outlier states where one party had the power to do the other party in and the will to do so. The norm is not that. The norm is both parties getting together and just protecting incumbents, or one party having power and just protecting incumbents because that's all that they really care about. So we looked at the national distribution of votes for Congress in all elections between 1946 and the present. And what we found is really quite remarkable that basically parties stay pretty close to each other throughout the entire period. And that's kind of an interesting little finding, given that you had the realignment of the South, given that you had the Civil Rights Movement, and various upheavals, Watergate. You can see where the upheavals are, the Watergate and the Johnson candidacy here. But basically, other than that, the parties are within a few percentage points of each other, and they never open up a consistently broad lead one or the other over the other. This table represents how big an increase in the share of the Republican versus Democratic vote any party enjoyed in any given year. And what you find is that it's really quite rare in post-war history for a party to pick up a 5% share. That is, that their 5% share increase by a party means a 10% swing in voting patterns. And so this occurs only 5 times in the post-war period. And it occurs, obviously, in 94 with the Republican realignment there. It occurs in 64 with a big Democratic sweep in 64. But keep this 5% number in mind and assume it to be quite rare because it's going to come back in a second. All right, this is the payoff. And so now we'll go to the next one.
Okay, I'll use this. If you would like me to explain this, what this is a distribution from red to green. Red indicates danger, means incumbent, you may lose. Green means heaven, bliss, no serious competition. And so the question is, at how many seats into the gut to the majority party coalition in Congress do we hit that safety point? That is, how at risk is the dominant party in Congress of losing its congressional majority? And that, of course, depends on how big the majority is. But if you look at the fifth most vulnerable seat, you find that in the 1940s, it's getting pretty close to red, and that means that it's about a 2%, that it's a 2% swing that would dislodge it, meaning the difference between the parties is less than 5%. And we define green as the way that political scientists generally have, as bigger than 10%. That is, it would take more than a 5% shift, 10% shift or a 5% gain by one party at the expense of the other to shift the election. And what we see is that historically, the first five seats are pretty dangerous to hold. The second five get less so. But that basically you never quite get to green, even at the 30-seat level. That is the 30th most vulnerable member of the governing coalition, of the governing party in Congress. Whereas by the time you get to 2004, you're basically in nirvana from seat one. And this is an indication that it is difficult to dislodge the parties. And I'm going to come back. I have 5 minutes. I'm going to come back to the underlying data in a second. But when we did this initially, there was a criticism that said, you're looking at national voter trends. How do you know that the results within a district follow the national voter trends? What happens if the marginal districts move differently from the national trends? It may be that there really is competition that's lurking here. And so, one more effect before I get to answering that question. This is what it would take in 2004 to pick up seats compared to historically in 1980 and 1966. The reason we pick these years is that these years have almost identical differentials between Republicans and Democrats in the power of the governing coalition. And so what you see is an is a gradual increase from a pretty low baseline of about 1% to pick up the first seats through about 4% to pick up, I forget how many, I think this is about the 20-seat level. And because these numbers are incorrect here, I'm sorry. And but what you see in 2004 is that you get virtually nothing until you pick up at about 5%. So that there is a big cushion that the incumbents have, that there basically has to be a 5% pickup by the Democrats before they have a chance of getting any seats at all. In fact, they have to get almost 6% in order to pick up five seats in 2006. Now, that's significant because for two reasons. First, political science has generally defined 10% as being a safe, non-competitive election, so that basically the most competitive elections in 2006 are ones that historically we would have defined as non-competitive. And second, it indicates that we have to hit in 2006 margins of swings in voter preference from 2004 that you'll recall we've only hit four times in the post-war period. So it's a really hard task for the Democrats to take back the House. Now, there's still only a limited number of Democratic and Republican votes, and what you find historically is, this is not the clearest, but the bottom line is basically the seats-votes ratio over time since the post-war period, and what you find generally is the more votes you get, the more seats you pick up. There's a pretty linear direction relation between them. What you find in 2004 is that there's a flat plateau initially, and then you go up quickly, and then you plateau out again. So it's more of an S-shaped curve, which we could have accentuated by shrinking this, but we haven't done that yet. When we publish it, we'll shrink it from side to side. Some of you will see this in a more pronounced fashion. It's called cheating. The point is that what will happen in this election is that the Democrats need to hit a very high plateau to start picking up any seats. But once they hit that plateau, they're going to pick up a lot of seats. So this is an election where the likeliest outcome is that the Democrats will effectively pick up nothing, or they will pick up somewhere in the 20-30 seat range for reasons I'll show you next. This is the response to the critique that that what happens in the marginal districts is different than what happens overall. And so we lined up what we would have predicted from our data with what actually happened. And you see, it's, you know, it's not bad. I mean, we're pretty much there. And if you want to do, you know, these statistics don't tell you anything, but it's nice. We got a correlation of 0.99, so take that, you know, social scientist creeps. So here's the all the data since World War II. And what I want to point out is down here. That is, if you look at the mean between 1946 and 1990, what you find is to pick up the first five seats from the opposition party, you need a 2.2 gain. That is, they're less than 5% margin between them. They are highly competitive. To pick up the first 10 seats, you need 3.0. To pick up the first 15, you need 3.8. And to pick up the first 30, you need 5.8. So you want to pick up 30 seats, you got to do a lot of work. You got to really win that election. But you don't have to do that much work to pick up 5, 10, even 15 seats. Keep in mind, 15 is what the Democrats need this time. 2004, to pick up the first 5 seats, you got to get 5.7. And 5.7 is virtually the same as what the 30th seat used to look like before the 2000 round of redistricting. And the interesting thing is that it then plateaus. I don't know where what happened. We're missing a figure. It then plateaus, but if you get 6.1%, you pick up 15 seats, and I think the number is if you get 6.7, you pick up 30 seats. And so you see that the threshold is much higher. So the point is not that the Democrats can't, that there can't be a shift in the House. The point is that there's what we call an insulation effect, that there is less accountability of the governing coalition to voter dissatisfaction because voter dissatisfaction has to now cross this very high threshold before it can manifest itself in a shift in control of Congress. I think that's my last one. Yeah, done.
Come up with anything about why that's how that plays out in your legal theory? You just want to leave it for questions?
No, this is. I've written too much on that. This is just facts, and that's all I got.
So I'd like to join the earlier comments in thanking Ned and Steve and Dan and the good folks here who organized this conference and the Law Journal for all their good work in putting this together. Jim told me that I was responding to the two previous speakers, and I learned that as I sat down here. So it turns out actually what I'm going to say may be slightly more responsive than I initially thought, which may be a good thing. Sam started by saying that the court hasn't quite figured out what the harm is, and I'm going to talk about the Texas case with an eye to saying that maybe they're on their way to doing just that. So I'll begin with an observation that many people in this room have already made, and that's the practice of losers in partisan districting battles to file lawsuits challenging the resulting districting plans under seemingly unrelated doctrines. They file lawsuits, they allege malapportionment, racial vote dilution, racial gerrymandering, and they periodically prevail. And a lot of people in the voting rights community or voting rights scholars, including the people sitting on this panel, think that's worry about these lawsuits. They think they're not a great thing, that they needlessly racialize what are partisan disputes. They distort the underlying doctrines that were meant for other purposes, and they give us an inadequate remedy to partisan gerrymandering. And I'm going to suggest today that I'm not convinced that we have a problem here. And what I want to suggest is that the application of distinct doctrines to invalidate or diminish what are indisputably partisan gerrymanders is not necessarily problematic and might even have a salutary effect. And I start with a premise that I think I heard Sam to share, but maybe not, and that premise is that the court was right to reject the recent recent challenges to partisan gerrymandering in the Veith case, in the Texas case, and as well as the conviction, I don't know if Sam has his conviction or not, that there is a workable principle out there to manage the practice. So I'm going to talk about the Texas case because we're here to talk about the Roberts Court, and so why not talk about the Texas case, and that's actually what I thought the panel was on. So what happens in the Texas case? The court's unable to find anything constitutionally problematic with the blatant gerrymander that if you were awake in the early, last 5 years you heard about. They can't find anything that's constitutionally wrong with it, but they find traction under the Voting Rights Act and say that the state diluted minority voting strength in the southwest portion of the state, and specifically that Texas violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act when it took 100,000 Latino residents out of Laredo to shore up the reelection prospects of Representative Bonilla, who the Latino voters seem not to like very much. And I don't want to take – I mean, I'm not going to dispute that Texas's foray into redistricting, clearly a patently partisan affair, but the state goes about it through conscious race-based districting moves such that the resulting claims of race-based injury, I would say, are not an ancillary distraction from a core dispute, but in fact the predictable consequence of how the state went about doing what it did. What I think is more important, or what I whether I'll persuade anyone or not, what I want to suggest today is the extent to which, in the case, the court's concern about partisan gerrymandering, and in particular, its concern about the relentless pursuit of incumbency protection, propelled and shaped the race-based injury that the justices recognize in the Lulock case. The justices. Justice Kennedy viewed the Latino community in Laredo as cohesive and discrete in the traditional sense, but he also says several things that I think are interesting and curious, and particularly he emphasizes the fact that the Latino voters in Laredo are politically active. He says it again and again. They're politically active. They're engaged in what had been a competitive political environment. And what I want to suggest is it was this political engagement, this level of involvement by Latino voters in Laredo that made their political influence worth protecting for the court. And what, and this will take up, maybe Gil just disagree with me on this, what I think distinguishes, distinguished Latino voters in Laredo from African-American voters in Fort Worth, or at least in the court's view of this. And I guess my premise, if you push me on it, is that if Tom DeLay waited 5 years, well, I guess he couldn't have waited 5 years, but had he waited 5 years to engage in this, and District 23 had become solidly majority Latino when they were electing their candidate of choice, I don't know that this case comes out the same way. It's the cusp of victory. It's the engagement and the involvement that's critical to the court, as I read it, and since we can make this stuff up as we go along, that's what I'll say the court was up to in this case. For in Justice Kennedy's controlling view, that's not what was going on in Laredo, in Fort Worth, rather. And that the pervasive lack of competition in the Fort Worth district meant that meaningful voter preferences couldn't be expressed, couldn't be ascertained, and as a result, the state's decision to dismantle the district couldn't give rise to vote dilution in any meaningful or measurable sense. I think when Justice Kennedy looked at Fort Worth, he saw missing from it the vibrancy that he saw in Laredo, and for this reason saw that there was no representational harm suffered in Fort Worth, and that in effect the state's decision to dismantle the district was immune from liability under Section 2. So I think from this I take the following principle, that the court, by protecting Latino voters in Laredo and not protecting or denying relief to black voters in Fort Worth, is suggesting, and it's a suggestion and I'm reading a lot into it, admittedly, but is suggesting that minority voters have a protected right to participate in a competitive political arena, but not in a non-competitive one. And if that's a proposition that the court takes up and follows, if it develops that in later cases, that's a dramatically new approach to minority voting rights. And it's one that all but repudiates traditional efforts to protect minority groups, where we basically looked at cohesive minority groups and tried to shield them from political competition. And given everything that Sam just told us, given the scope of non-competitive districts in the U.S. today, it means the reach of Section 2 is going to be a whole lot smaller than it would be. Pam Carlin's not here yet, so I can say this and maybe not get yelled at, but I think I might get yelled at anyway. I'm going to say that I'm inclined to welcome the move anyway, notwithstanding the newness of it and the chance that Section 2 is going to be a lot more narrow than it was, that by redefining the type of race-based community that's entitled to statutory protection, this court that has long been so wary of the voting rights of Section 2 was able to identify for the first time since 1982 actual conduct, an actual race-based community entitled to protection. And I think that is not an inconsequential acknowledgement, particularly the number of times I could say this court, but I'll just substitute Justice Kennedy, in recent years has struck down efforts by states to create politically defined, racially defined political communities. So I think what follows from that is an acknowledgement that race need not always be a problem we have to overcome, but it actually can be a positive trait that links us in good ways and gives rise to at least some communities that warrant statutory protection. Let me backtrack a little on why I think the court has been wary and how remarkable this is. The wariness of the court to the Voting Rights Act and to Section 2 in particular dates to stuff we heard that John Roberts had to say back in 1982 when he was a young lawyer in the Justice Department, when he was screaming and yelling and saying, don't amend the Voting Rights Act, don't create a results-based test for discrimination, because if you do that, we're going to have a quota system, we're going to have proportional representation. He says that he loses, Congress amends the statute, but the concerns he raised continue to pervade how courts look at Section 2 over the last 25 years. And they don't ever come back and say, oh, we're not going to follow the amendments. But in applying the statute, they are grudging, or at least many of them are grudging, and they do two things. They look, I think, they resist what I would say are the two underlying principles that animated Congress to amend the statute, animated Congress, that I think underlie the 1982 amendments. And number one is they discount or disregard evidence that suggests anything other than discriminatory intent on the part of the actors involved. They look at the Senate factors, they look at the components of the Section 2 inquiry, and unless it's pointing to discriminatory event, they disregard, they diminish, they don't pay heed to it. They also do a second thing, which I think is less salient, but important, and that is that they equate the ability to register and vote with full political participation. And I think an animating principle behind underlying the 82 amendments is that that's not enough for full participation. And you can go back to Judge Pittman, who sided with the Mobile plaintiffs way back in the 70s. And what has Judge Pittman said? He says, look, African-American voters in Mobile in the 1970s are faced with a classic case of racial vote dilution. It remains the classic example of it. They do not have full voting rights, he tells us, notwithstanding the fact that they register and vote without hindrance. And I think that is a premise underlying the 82 amendments. It's a premise that federal courts, lower federal courts, have resisted. Not every federal court, but many federal courts have resisted over the last 25 years. And I think we might have expected LULAC to follow suit. And what I think is so noteworthy about the case is it doesn't. It doesn't do any of that. And I would say, and then maybe I'm overreading again, but it embraces the Voting Rights Act in a way that I found at least quite surprising, with the breadth with which the court, or Justice Kennedy again, administered or evaluated a bunch of these factors. And I don't think that's because he's gotten over the fear of quotas and proportional representation, but rather that the court has found something else that might work as a curb against that practice, and namely the idea that maybe a competitive election might just be something we like or we might want to protect. Let me say two more things, if I may. If I can figure out where I am. Yeah. Okay, two more things. The first is the notion that why I think this is a good thing. And I think in part that comes from the fact that we have substantial challenges pending, looming, to the Voting Rights Act as it's been reauthorized. We have principles objections that could be raised against the constitutionality of Section 2 itself. And with that in the wings, I think making racial vote dilution contingent on competitive elections, if in fact that's where the court is going with that, might well be a constructive development, and that encouraging such elections might be a promising alternative to conventional means for protecting minority voting rights through safe districts. Simply put, I think we should be skeptical about the quality of political participation and representation in a wholly non-competitive district, particularly when that lack of competition seeps into the primary, as it did in Fort Worth. And so here's this crazy idea that minority voters might just be better served if politicians are actually vying for their votes. In closing, I guess the crazy idea is that maybe all of us would be better served if politicians actually were vying for our votes. And that's why coming back to where I start, I don't think the vote dilution component of LULAC is a distraction from the partisan gerrymandering component of the case, and that LULAC's suggestion, as I read it, that competition gives rise to political participation worth protecting under Section 2, invites Justice Kennedy, to articulate a representational harm that's more broad than that, and namely that the right to vote should encompass something more than the ability to cast a ballot for a preordained victor. I agree with Sam, maybe I mischaracterized this. I think the court was exactly right to turn back these latest challenges brought by sore losers in the districting process, demanding a greater share of the districting spoils. These are a bunch. My grandmother, if she were alive, would have said this was chutzpah for the Democrats after what they've done for the last 30 years to come into court and say, "Gee whiz, we're really upset about this now." And I think the court was right to send them on their way. I think LULAC's Section 2 analysis suggests a more workable and more palatable principle, and suggests a nascent conception of representational harm suffered by all voters when a political system is rigged to prevent competition. And I'm done.
First thing I
want
to do is give panelists a chance to say anything they want to say about anything they want to say.
I found Alan's take on this remarkable and really intriguing. When Rick Pillis and I first presented the Politics as Markets thesis at a conference at Stanford some years ago, the critique was that by Bruce Cain was that this is un-American, communistic, puts lawyers in charge, will give courts too much power. It's unbounded. Rick Hazen made that point at the time. There's no metric for competition, so on and so forth. Over time, that critique diminished. And at the AALS a couple of years ago, Bruce made the argument if you pursue this, you're going to run up against Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that ultimately one of the main obstacles to competition is the compulsion to draw safe minority districts. And so now, how are you going to reconcile your competition metric with Section 2? And Ellen is taking up that challenge, and I think quite bravely, and saying not only does it run up against the inherited applications of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, it must and it should, if I understand you correctly, because if our goal is to embolden minorities to be active participants in the political process, there is nothing more deadening than guaranteed outcomes in elections. Why bother to vote in elections, you know, do I vote in congressional elections in my district on the west side of New York? Come on, I have work to get done. There's no point to it. Give me a contested election and I'll turn out. And to read that into the court's take on Section 2, I find quite interesting, quite provocative. I don't quite join completely on the characterization of the Texas case, only in the sense that Bert Newborn and Rick Pillis and I tried to argue that there was a different approach taken on elections clause basis for taking this out of the hands of incumbent of political officials altogether. The court didn't pick up on that. But leaving that aside, on the claim that the Democrats who, you know, I represented the Democrats in Texas in the 1990s, we did a good job. You know, we had a minority of votes and we got a majority of seats. You can't do better than that, and tied them up in the courts for a decade after that until Vera came along. You can't justify the Democrats' claim of, oh my God, there's gerrymandering going on here. Who would have thunk it? So I appreciate that. I thought it was great.
I guess the only comment that I would have on that is to test the theory, you'd have to think about whether dismantling safe districts of color would not run into a Section 2 violation, and in fact would be required by LULAC, right? And I think that would be very difficult to justify. That is, if one were to say, okay, if the safe districts are no longer protected, we can move them about as we wish.
Are you making the same distinction you made before, the naturally occurring?
Well, it may be. I mean, we want to have an argument about whether it's naturally occurring or not. But I think that would be the initial place to start, is to think whether one could dismantle safe districts without, and I don't think you could, without a vigorous Section 2 violation. So I think that's one way of backdooring and thinking about how what the theory means. I actually found Ellen's take quite brilliant, though I disagree with it precisely because I just don't. Justice Kennedy says, well, these are active voters, but there's no sense of what does that mean, or are the other voters not active, are people not voting, are they not registering, or, you know, what, give us a sense. So there seems to be much more post hoc conclusory justifications than actually explanations and historical evidence. But that's a characteristic of LULAC itself and not just that point.
Me brilliant, so I should stop. But I think it's curious that if the court really didn't, I mean, I thought Martin Frost was going down after what I heard reported so ably about the argument in the case, and I thought, well, that clearly that's going nowhere. And what I thought the court would do is what I thought a court would do that's wary of the Voting Rights Act in Section 2 and say coalition districts. Those things are absurd. We're not protecting those because there's not racial bloc voting in a coalition district because you're making coalitions, and so definitionally, this is great interest group politics, and we are not going to protect that under the statute. And the court doesn't go there. That was the opening, and of course, the court said we don't have to reach that here. reach it. You know, come on. I mean, if you want to get rid of this thing, get rid of this thing. And instead what the court does is they give us this weird, that's a district that's dismantled, right? We're dismantling a district where Martin Frost gets the highest NAACP rating. You know, everybody loves him. Or maybe they love someone else. This gets dismantled and we don't care because there's no competition. Not because we can't tell that black people prefer Martin Frost, because as some abstract matter about it, and I think the logic of that, the absence of a Section 2 violation there, arguably transcends to a majority-minority district as well that is dismantled. Rick's paper alludes to the Georgia versus Ashcroft fix in the Voting Rights Act right now. And so, I mean, I think there's some question if Congress is now lined up and saying, we love majority-minority districts and you can't unpack them because we think there's retrogression, I guess, if you do so. Where does that stand given this holding here? And it may simply suggest that Section 2 and Section 5 are just going to continue to diverge all the more, or that the reauthorized statute is simply going to be struck down on that or other grounds.
As Sam said, I had a chance to comment on his paper at the APSA meetings, and I did it with my usual tact, and I'm glad to see that Sam was able to detect a critical note hidden in my comments. So I won't do it here. I'll just say that if anybody is interested in this subject, I would be delighted to talk to you later about a lack of partisan competition is not among the 16,000 top problems facing the United States electoral system nowadays. And B, why even if it were, or even if it were something you wanted to do something about, tinkering around with redistricting would be a very ineffective way to do that. So instead, I'd like to comment on Guy's paper and make two comments, really. One of which I guess would be cautionary, and the other is, I think, quite supportive. The cautionary has to do with the assertion that what they're really about is, in striking down District 23, is controlling partisan gerrymandering. That might be true in terms of what the motives are of one or more of the justices who made up the majority. I don't know. But I would the cautionary note would be, even assuming that is true, how much difference does it really make and why? Karcher versus Daggett is a case where I think many people, and I think reasonably, believe that probably at least part of what was driving some of the justices was the partisan gerrymander there, and yet the case was decided on purely on population grounds. And I think it would be hard to say that that case has had very much of an effect on the partisan gerrymandering question since then. So even if you're right, is it really going to matter and if, in terms of the course of future litigation and the development of the law? And if not, then, you know, how important a point is it? Now, the supportive point, and I really appreciated this, where you concluded the problems that Justice Kennedy's approach can create for minority legislators and minority leaders. In the second North Carolina racial gerrymandering case, Shaw 2, Chief Justice Rehnquist addressed the defense offered by North Carolina. One of the defenses was, we created this highway district so that we could comply with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And Chief Justice Rehnquist's response to that was, well, wait a minute, the compact area whereby Jingles analysis might have required you to create a second black majority district was in a different part of the state. And so you weren't complying with Section 2 by creating the district where you did. Now, implicit in that, I think clearly implicit in that, is if there had been a, if instead of the racial gerrymandering attack being made, if there had been a Section 2 claim against the plan that North Carolina adopted based on the failure to create a black majority district in the southeast part of the state, Chief Justice Rehnquist would have supported that claim and would have said that you can require North Carolina to create a third district. Now, I believed and wrote at the time that that was disingenuous, it was intellectually dishonest, that there was no chance in the world that Chief Justice Rehnquist would have reacted that way, and that it would not have been appropriate under the law as it had been set forth up to that time. Now, what's happened here is that Justice Kennedy has taken that seriously, and he has relied on it as a basis for striking down District 23. He says that you haven't, or just by creating a black majority district in District 25, you haven't dealt with your Laredo problem. And what that means is that when the legislature goes about complying with its legal responsibilities, plus whatever moral or political mandate it may feel it has, to create majority-minority districts or to create political opportunities for minorities in various ways, it is more restricted than it would otherwise be. Now, obviously, my general approach to redistricting is I would like the court to leave state legislatures as unrestricted as possible. There are population requirements, there are racial requirements, and I don't believe, and then after that, I believe it should be a purely political issue. But I think there are particularly serious problems when they constrain the legislatures more than is necessary in the racial context, and I think this is where your point comes in, that all it does is further hamstring minority members. It interferes with their ability to negotiate and bargain with other members of the legislature, because the legislature is more hemmed in on how it can deal with racial issues. And I think that, I mean, that was basically the view that I took in the Stanford Law Review article I wrote in 1998, and I thought, you know, I was really glad to see you come up, you know, sort of converge in a way, coming from a different direction, and I really did appreciate that part of your paper.
My comments are really addressed to Sam, and I sort of feel guilty about looking a gift compliment in the mouth, as you were nice enough to refer to me at the start. But it does go to your question about before you have a solution, you have to identify the problem. And I think you've done an excellent job of saying if you think the problem is insulation or lack of competitiveness, that's what we're getting. But I think the problem or the question on the court is that the problem? It sort of relates to Dan's point at the beginning. Because that argument was sort of made, or maybe you may have made it directly, and it sort of was raised. It's clearly implicit in the partisan gerrymandering part, where it was clear that the redistricting was an intense partisan manipulation. And what is Justice Kennedy's response? I'm being the court in this case. Justice Kennedy's response is, let's look at the results. And in fact, if you look at the seats votes relationship in Texas under the old plan, with two pro-Democrats. Democrats way too many seats relative to the vote share. If you look at it now, it's a nice fit. So his concern was not the competitiveness within districts or the manipulation of districts, but the relationship between seats and votes. And this is literally back of the envelope calculations that I was doing while you were talking. If you look at these last six elections, 2004, the seats-votes relationship is remarkably close. And I actually did the numbers as to what the Democrats got and what the Democrats would have gotten using these national figures, which may not be a wise thing, but using the national figures. And basically, one year they got one seat more, one year they had 10 seats less, that was the biggest departure, four seats less, one seat more. The average departure between what they should have gotten if you took 46.4 or 49.5 and applied it to 435, on average, over the course of six elections, the deviation was 4.8 seats, which given the base is about 2%. If you take the two elections that you singled out before as elections in which there was a big swing, and big swing led to big results, 1966 and 1980, basically in those years the Democrats were in charge, they were overrepresented by 25 in 1966 and by 21 in 1980, and basically they were 10% overrepresented relative to being about 2% underrepresented under the current system. So it may be that if the problem is non-competitiveness in the districts, we have a problem. But if the problem is, if the issue in districting is a seats-votes relationship, we actually have much less of a problem nationally then I don't believe, I believe you. My own view is closer to your definition of the problem. But if we're trying to get a sense of persuade other people what the problem is, this supports your measure that if you begin by thinking that your thing is the problem, this is the problem. But it doesn't come close to addressing the belief of others who think the relationship is seats and votes, because if anything, we have a much closer relationship of seats and votes in the House now than we did in either of the two flagship elections that you were using. And one minor thought also is let me just stop with that, because that was sort of what hit me, is that as you look at these numbers, the House in the aggregate is very close to what the matchup of the vote is, and much closer. I obviously didn't have time to do all 40 elections, but to the two elections you singled out.
Well, we have a break, and so you can finish
your math. Exactly.
I fully agree with you, Richard, that it wasn't our purpose in this, but it has the effect of saying that if you think the problem in American politics is that one party or the other is being systematically disadvantaged by the redistricting process, tough case to make. And Ellen's characterization of my views on Veith and LULAC is not incorrect. I mean, that I basically think that to the extent the Democrats are coming in and saying the system was much better before when we were drastically overrepresented in congressional representation, that I understand why the Democrats would feel that way, but I don't think that that's something that the court can take constitutional cognizance of. So I fully agree with that. The difficulty is it depends, you're exactly right, depends on your sense of what the problem is. If you have a view that the ultimate end state of democratic legitimacy is accountability, then the bigger that insulation index, the less accountable elected officials are. And so, for example, this year, as I understand it in California, the betting line is that not a single seat in any legislature, state legislative district, congressional district, will change hands, and that the only incumbents who will be displaced are those who've been term limited out, retired, or died. And otherwise, there will be no change whatsoever. And this is a state that not too many years ago booted out its governor in a kind of majoritarian uprising. So I think that that's a problem. And I think that the issue here, two final points. One is, again, the way the question is presented to the court when the Democrats or Republicans come in and say, we've been had, these data support the answer that you're getting, which is, you know what, if that's your claim, the system's working pretty well. And here, oddly, I agree with Dan. If your concern is accountability of elected officials to swings in voter mood, in voter preferences, then I think these data do show a problem. There's one thing that could happen that the data indicate. This year, if the Democrats pick up 4%, for the first time in the post-war period, you will have a party that gets an absolute majority of congressional votes cast nationally. And that's a funny measure because you have a lot of uncontested districts and all that who will end up with a minority in Congress. So that's a flukish.
That would begin to carry your theory to rebut the alternative theory, what the representation ought to be about, because you're making the accountability point. Others would take the mirror theory.
Right.
And I think you get real traction if it moves from accountability and begins to pick up the mirror theory, and that would require, as you say, a swing of near but under 5%,
right,
if your analysis is right.
Flying in this morning, Rick Pillis asked me, what is it you really want? Because, do you want to, like, score a few points academically, or would you like Congress to tip? And I said,
Good question.
I'm always in favor of scoring points, but I'm trying to figure out a way to do both. But
the risk of violating all rules, I just want to throw in one last thing, and this is more for maybe for political science analysis. I also was struck by the fact, looking at the numbers, that you're doing this theory on data where the last four elections had the lowest swing of any group of four elections in your entire period, and whether that affects this at all. The fact that you had three elections where the swing was under 1%, there's no other period of time in the 40-year period you're looking at
where
that happened. So how much of this correlates to the fact that just low swing absolutely, and whether that's a factor.
The interesting thing is that, as best I could tell, nobody had really put all these numbers together until we did. Others have the data. I mean, Gary Jacobson, we were using Gary Jacobson's data, but it's kind of interesting just to look at it. And, just the simple fact that the two parties stay pretty close to each other at the 50%, that's kind of a Duverger moment, right? That it's the data themselves are interesting.
Thank you.
had one question for Sam, and then I wanted to talk about Texas. Do you think it's possible, given the increasing polarization in the House and maybe the increasing polarization of voters, it's hard to separate those two out, that because the parties now much more clearly stand for different positions, we're more likely to see larger swings in the national vote for Congress, because what happens in, you know, individual places will be reflected in other places. These elections may be less local and more national. And so one of the consequences of what you're describing is that maybe this fall we'll see a much larger swing than looks possible when you use that 5% figure looking back earlier. And if that were true, the issue of accountability still requires a judgment about whether it's kind of accountability district by district or accountability of Congress as a whole to national sentiment. And a more polarized Congress might generate that kind of national accountability because we'll see these larger swings in voting patterns. So that's just the question for you. For Guy primarily on Texas, but to some extent Ellen also, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at what I've put together in Texas, but I'm shocked to hear the sort of positive account of this decision and its implications for the Voting Rights Act, because I read it exactly the opposite way. Justice Kennedy, right out of the box in the oral argument, said this district that runs from Austin to the Rio Grande and lumps Hispanics on the border with Hispanics in the state capital of Austin, urban, rural, all these differences. First thing he said is, this is insulting. That was his word. This uses race in an insulting way. And I see the entire opinion, Justice Kennedy's contribution to it, which is the court's center, we all assume, on these issues, as being driven overwhelmingly by the same kind of revulsion at that district that he had at the district in Shaw and in the Shaw cases. It gets expressed in a different legal form, I think a legal form that is even more of a signal that the Roberts Court is heading towards really dramatically reducing the legal obligation to create safe minority districts than in the Shaw cases themselves, which I thought were more modest kind of interventions. Because, again, contrary to the way you presented it, this is the strongest statement in the districting context against the racial essentialization idea. Justice Kennedy says, look, even though the Latinos in Austin and at the Rio Grande vote for Hispanic candidates when pitted against white candidates, that's not enough. They have to have more commonality than that. And here are these voters with massive socioeconomic differences, rural-urban kinds of differences, educational differences. What the decision says about the Voting Rights Act is that before a district like this is required under the Act, minority voters have to be kind of ideologically coherent in some way beyond voting for Hispanic candidates. Or they have to be culturally compact, as Dan Ortiz says, as well as geographically compact. And that is about destabilizing a position for the conventional understanding of minority vote dilution, as one could imagine. Justice Kennedy was always more resistant to safe minority districting than Justice O'Connor. So again, when you say, well, this is not like the Shaw cases, I think quite the opposite. This is Justice Kennedy now in charge of the court on this issue and finding yet further ways to express a resistance to understanding the Voting Rights Act to require the creation of safe minority districts when voting is polarized in the conventional way. And the way I now increasingly see this is that the legal view from the Supreme Court that safe minority election districts, I'm sorry, I'm sick, that safe minority election districts were required by the Voting Rights Act was an idea that burst into life in jingles in the mid-80s and had a very short life. And essentially every time since jingles that the court has had an opportunity to try to cabin that and put that genie back in the bottle, it's done so, whether it's under Section 2 of the Act, whether it's under Section 5 of the Act, Georgia versus Ashcraft, whether it's under Shaw and the constitutional cases. And if Kennedy remains the center of the court, LULAC seems to me a marker that in all the different ways in which Voting Rights Act issues come before the court, he's going to be pushing this anti-essentialist view of the Act. And what I think he's groping for, and the court as the center of the court as a whole is groping for, is a way to try to define the boundary between what they think of as legitimately truly intentional racial discrimination when election districts are designed versus a mandate to create safe minority districts, which they find very troubling kind of across the board, except in that context. And I think that the intuitive idea, as I said and you mentioned, is that when a minority district would be naturally arising, meaning that minority voters are actually geographically fairly concentrated, and because they're fairly concentrated geographically, they're more likely to share socioeconomic and other sorts of interests, and the state goes out of its way to dismantle that district, which is what Texas did with the Laredo district, or goes out of its way to avoid creating that district, when it artificially manipulates the process, then that's what the Voting Rights Act is about. But short of that, they are have been very reluctant from the moment of Jingles on to endorse the practice that developed in the shadow of the doctrine, where many legislators and lawyers and lower court judges thought there was an obligation to create these districts. Every time they come back in, they say, not here, not here, not for this reason, not in this context. And LULAC, to me, is the most destabilizing of all of these decisions, and I see it as a decision really driven by revulsion at that Austin-Rio Grande district.
Well, at some level, I guess I find myself between you and Alan in the sense that I think there, that's obviously a plausible reading, but when you look at District 23, I think it's a bit of a stretch, it seems to me anyway, sort of looking at the on-the-ground facts, to say that it is, you know, it's naturally occurring, but it's also a district with a fairly wide spread to it, right? And the way in which Justice Kennedy talks about that district is, at least as I view it and read it compared to what he did before, is different in the way in which he talked previously about the VRA and Miller, and to some extent the way that he talks about District 25. So it seems to me that in some senses you have two opinions that are going on, and this is where, you know, I think Ellen's read is, well, the court is solicitous of a Section 2 claim in ways that has never been before. And I think that's right, because that's one district. And your read of the court being hostile or more hostile to a conception of the VRA than it's ever been before, I think that's right, because that's another district. And the question is, can you reconcile those two reads? And my argument is you can't reconcile them as either a pro-racial representation view, so there I would agree with you, and you can't reconcile them as an extreme anti-essentialism view, and there I would agree with Ellen. So there's got to be another justification for how we think about it, and to me the justification is that it's really, you know, the court is really not thinking about race, you know, it's not or really about the VRA and a reaction to the VRA, although I agree with you that this is bad for the Voting Rights Act, because I think it's going to lead to a narrower conception of the Voting Rights Act, but I don't think it is in the mold of, or even beyond the mold of Shaw, because at least the language of the opinion, perhaps of the oral argument, the language of the opinion does not, at least the way that I read it, does not quite get that far. So I don't think this is a strong argument in favor of racial representation by any means, but I also don't think that it's an argument that sorely undermines that concept, because in some ways you have two different opinions, and I think that's why we can have those two different readings of that opinion. And to some extent, I think they're inconsistent with one another.
Can I just very briefly respond? I actually think the opinion works together as a fairly unified whole, because what the court saw with the district that they struck down was a deeply cynical use of race or ethnicity. They saw the Republicans driving all the Hispanics out of that district, but keeping just enough Hispanics in so it gets over the 50.1% line, so it kind of looks like it's a Hispanic district still. And they talk about it as an intentionally discriminatory district design. And I see the opinion as being unified around trying to drive out the intentional use of race in the process, whether it's cynically used in District 23 or used to try to compensate for the cynical use of race.
Right, but would one look at District 23 and say, this is the state acting to intentionally discriminate against Latino voters, right?
That's how Justice Kennedy saw it, in my view.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is not consistent with our traditional conception of intentional discrimination. Now, that may become the new conception of intentional discrimination, but it's not consistent with the traditional conception of intentional discrimination.
I have Linda, Brad, Ned, and we're 5 minutes over our time. We could all day stay here and run into the next panel, but I just want everyone to know that.
Okay, I'll be brief. Just maybe a way to maybe reconcile Rick's alarmist take on the opinion with Ellen's very optimistic and I found, you know, fascinating take, is that it's possible that going on 25 years after Jingles, you know, we're in a new world. And I remember when Shaw came down and I got reaction to it from members of the Congressional Black Caucus and so on, their take was, because of this opinion, the number of black members of Congress won't fill a telephone booth within the next 2 years. Well, of course, that wasn't the case, and we have had a fairly, robust life in terms of minority representation ongoing. And so it's just very interesting that yes, LULAC can be a watershed. It can be the kind of cutting edge of a new understanding of our representational politics. And just one quick comment. One thing that I thought was so fascinating about the case is that, of course, everybody looked at the case as, Veith II and, Wither gerrymandering and so on. And the Laredo piece of the case, which was incredibly well briefed and argued by Maldef, by Nina Perales, was kind of the secondary question in it. And I think the court had a hard time when they considered what to do with the case, and they took it to conference, seven or eight times, and it was, of course, a jurisdictional statement, and they had to do something, and I think they were fighting out which pieces of it to grant for plenary review and which to just do summarily. I think it wasn't that clear a thing that they were even going to take the Laredo case, part of it, and you've explained it to me in a way that makes it one of the most interesting and novel developments in this area in many years. So I thank you for illuminating me.
At some point, it doesn't have to be today or tomorrow, but at some point to hear more about this, because that explains why it's not just masquerading as a partisan gerrymandering case. If Democrats have been sliced in half in Laredo by itself, and Kennedy would have said, you know, I haven't heard a theory yet why I should be worried about that. But if, because Latinos are sliced in half, it feels like a million to him. And whether that's a naturally occurring Latino community, compact or not, I think it's that it exists as sort of a reliance interest. Whether District 23 is a real thing or a fabricated thing, it's the thing that gets taken away. And when you take it away, and it's race-based taken away, that's intentional discrimination. So that's the real opinion. It doesn't actually get written. But it seems to me that's the actual decision. I don't know whether
I agree. I think you're right. I mean, I think when Kennedy starts the argument, he's going after intent, and he's going to go on Shaw, and it looks like that. So why doesn't he do it, right? It all sounds in Shaw. It sounds like he wants to do it. And he doesn't have a court, and maybe he's loving being Justice O'Connor, and he's playing both sides, and he likes this new role. I don't think he enjoys that role that much. But in any event, maybe that's what he does. I think intent... I mean, it's weird. He doesn't say it's discriminatory intent. It kind of sounds like discriminatory intent, but he doesn't quite go there. And I think if the court is really holding that this is race-based discriminatory intent under Section 2, I don't know what that even means, but if that's what it's doing, what's he talking about with Chief Justice about whether District 25 is adequate compensation? If this is intentional race-based discrimination, you can't compensate for that in Austin. So that whole discussion is besides the point. I also think there's a lot of language, and maybe I just want to overread it, about cohesiveness, about activity, about the history of discrimination and their registering and all this stuff about how great these Latino voters are. We love them. The opinion. I mean, circle how many times politically active, on the cusp of victory, took away their opportunity. That sounds an effect to me. It doesn't sound solely in intent. I also want to say, and you're going to tell me this could be totally wrong too, I think it's remarkable that he doesn't go with Shaw, he gets the court, and how much the Chief Justice is actually on board. Now, granted, the Chief Justice's opinion in dissent could simply be, I disagree with everything you just said, but even if you're right, District 25 is adequate compensation. He doesn't seem loath to, you know, say, Tony, you don't know what you're talking about. And so I think if he really disagreed on everything that came before, he might have pointed out, you're kind of expansive on the history of discrimination. You could go through a whole bunch of stuff. They're registering and voting. Maybe that's good enough. They haven't elected the candidate of choice. You could have eroded the claim, and he doesn't take issue with any of it. And he sure doesn't join the Scalia and Thomas saying these things aren't cognizable. So I could, you know, maybe I'm overreading it. He's, you know, worried about divvying us up by race, but he doesn't seem to have any problem with the court's articulation of the violation of Section 2 in District 23. He just thinks that they compensated for it sufficiently in Austin. And so maybe, I mean, you know, I'm not really a glass half full kind of girl, but maybe we could be here because, you know, maybe he's on board for a whole lot more. And you can say, no, this is just complicated. It was the end of the term. He was tired and he needed to go home.
But there's another point in Ned's comment, which is if this is Gamillion 2, it's worthwhile going back to Gamillion because Gamillion was long on the analysis of what the intent was. And then the court had a devil of a time trying to figure out what the harm was that was constitutionally cognizable there. So this has somewhat the feel of that, that there is a malevolent act toward this group that's constituted, that has this reliance interest and all that. But what exactly was taken away from them and what that constitutes is something that the court is having a hard time identifying here.
It seems to me you have to ask yourself this, just does Kennedy really care about Latino voters? What distinguishes these Latinos from these other Latinos other than a conclusory statement about how active they are? It seems to me that I think it's hard to really believe that that's really what's driving Justice Kennedy's opinion. My guess is that none of us would have predicted that we would get that language from Justice Kennedy and really think that he really cares, that this is really what's driving him. So it seems to me that there needs to be greater justification before you can reach we can reach that conclusion.
Yeah, just had a quick two comments that I don't want to get too far off the time table. But the first one is sort of just a follow-up on Richard and Rick's point that inter-party constitution is. There's a real obvious comment from political scientists, right, that Rick and Sam focus mostly on inter-candidate or intra-party or intra-district competition as opposed to inter-party competition. And what's interesting is you've seen over the last 15 years the strong nationalization of politics.
when you look at the partisan aspects of the case, right, the court has nothing to work with in a number of respects. So not just the fact that the Democrats are coming in with unclean hands, and the arguments that they're making makes the standard worse off than better off. So even with respect to the partisan bias standard that some members of the court, intriguingly enough, are interested in exploring, Justice Kennedy says, well, but even looking at that, that doesn't give us a sense across the state as to how we ought to think about this particular problem. So the court, seems to me anyway, doesn't have anything to work with on the partisan side, and is unwilling, or Justice Kennedy, I should say, is still unwilling to completely give it up. I mean, I sense my reading of Justice Kennedy here, a stronger willingness to perhaps put this to bed, but so far is unwilling to give it up and says very clearly that they're justiciable. So you have a justiciable claim without any standard whatsoever. And the question is, do you simply give up, or are there other ways that you can constrain what is happening? So that's, to me, the justification. When you dealt with the race case, for example, in Cromartie earlier, what you had was the court saying, as Sam has argued quite a bit, you had litigants using race, right, or using party to get away from race, saying, well, it's not about race but about party. But in this case, I think it's a little bit different because race is being used not necessarily to get away from parties but to check the partisan influence, right, to check the partisan influx. And I think that's a slightly different take from what you had before. And the justification for it is because the court is coming up empty so far on the partisan claims.
I could just add one word on this inter-party competition point. I think that it's a real important argument, but let's be careful about where it leads us, because it leads us to a very plebiscitary and unstable system where you build in incentives toward polarized parties, and the electorate will swing between one party and the other without intermediate officials who will broker deals and all the rest. And you get some of the features of a proportional representation system, some of the concerns about the instability of proportional representation. You'll get bigger swings because all of a sudden there's more market distances to cover. I mean, Michael, you know the political science literature better than I do, but there's a whole lot of writing on what happens if we go into fully national elections, not simply in the pivotal years where the parties are galvanized around a central issue as in 64 or 94, but as a norm, and the consequences for governance are really complicated. So I, you know, Rick, you may have Rick, but I'm nervous on this one.
I'm the one who said competition was a value, not the only value.
But he hasn't identified another one yet.
Rick,
that sounds to me like therapy is working.
Now, it'll start at 3:30 and it'll go to 5 p.m.
We got to get him to the same therapist.
I have one quick comment. It was from my attention that we ought to have some sort of means-based feedback for people who are doing symposiums, something I forgot to do. So I appreciate if you're willing to leave your email address at the registration table. I will send an email in a day or so, a couple days, just asking.
Yeah, there's a Thank you. flew down to Cincinnati.
Billy Elvis.
Halfway through an average ship.
Yeah, really, really.
Good. And there are that.
I saw Capitol in the news. Paul Karen. At the law school.
Oh, Capitol, the university is going down the tubes.
Well,
suing its old clients.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Now, things really have to get messy. So this friend of mine, one of my friends, I was joining a he says, now.
Thank you.
our last panel. Our technology people have of the day, excuse me, our last panel of the day. Get everybody after a good load of sugar, so hopefully we'll be all set. Our technology people have asked me to remind people to speak into the microphone because they are actually recording this for webcasting. And so even though we can hear everyone, the wonderful people out there in the world can't. So I will attempt to figure out how to make sure everybody has microphones when they talk, but we'll work on that. This panel is the panel on campaign finance. It's actually a fun panel for me because, as some of you know, I'm actually came into this profession and mainly right in the area of tax. So I don't generally know much about campaign finance. And when I started working in this area, I went and I read about six or seven people who I decided would give me at least a general overview. And three of those six or seven are on the panel. And I joked to myself, if you read Hassan Berfald and Smith, you get 80% of what people are thinking about in campaign finance. That's no insult to the remaining 20%, but it's a great group.
80% of what's wrong.
That's why you're going to nervous breakdown.
So it's a wonderful panel, and we're going to have Professor Hassan, who's going to speak on his paper for about 20 minutes. Professor Berfald, who's going to do the same on his paper, not on Professor Hassan's. And then Professor Smith is going to react to both their papers. So with that.
Thanks. The clicker's not working, so.
But since I follow instructions.
I should hold this. So I was at a symposium last spring with Dan Takagi at South Carolina. It's hard to keep them all straight. But it was about the Roberts Court and the promise of the Roberts Court. And I was thinking, you know, at least it's going to make things interesting. Because before the resignations, there was a sense that the court was getting tired. Heather Gerken talked about doctrinal interregnum, which I had to pick up my dictionary and look that one up. Sam Sakharov talked about throwing in the towel. And so I wrote this piece called No Exit. And if any of you remember Sartre's play, the last line is, hell is other people. And I got the sense that that's what how the nine justices of the Supreme Court were in this area, at least. They had already made all of their arguments, and they were just making them over again. So there was at least a sense that something new was coming down. And so I'm going to focus on what's new in the campaign finance area, focusing on the Randall v. Sorrell case, which was decided at the end of the last term. I call this paper The Newer Incoherence, and I want to explain why it's The Newer Incoherence. It's a sequel to my The New Incoherence, which I wrote about the McConnell opinion upholding McCain-Feingold, and it's a prequel to The Newest Incoherence, which I plan on writing after the Supreme Court decides the Wisconsin Right to Life case. I told this to someone I know who's at the FEC, and the person said, well, what comes after that? I said, coherence comes next, but that may be wishing for too much. So the paper has four aims, or four things I'm trying to do. The first is to show that Randall marks a shift in the Supreme Court's doctrine away from what I've characterized as the deference position towards deregulation, although not there yet. Second, I want to show that although a first read of the Randall opinion might give you the sense that the court's embracing the political markets or competition approach that Sam and Rick have put forward, I don't think that the court's actually done that, nor do I think it's added more coherence to the Supreme Court's doctrine in campaign finance. Third, I want to show that the workability of the Randall test of the plurality, how do you determine when a contribution limit is too low, the workability is very low. It's going to lead to a lot of conflict, I think, in the lower courts, and it's going to be driven by value judgments of the judges more than by the kind of scientific analysis that Justice Breyer suggests is possible in his plurality opinion. And then finally, I'll just talk about this briefly. I've written about another work, my calls for careful balancing as a better alternative to trying to work through these problems. Okay, so what did Randall involve? I've got 40 slides in 20 minutes, so I'm going to run through some of this quickly. I can post these slides somewhere, but I know as fast as I talk, Richard speaks faster, so this will be relatively slow. Randall did two things primarily. One is it examined the spending limits in the that were imposed by the Vermont legislature through Act 64. These included $300,000 spending limits for governor, so if you're running for governor, you couldn't spend more than that. And individual contribution limits, which were $400 for the governor, and that was per election cycle. So that meant for both the primary and the general. And they were down to $200 per election cycle for state representatives. Okay, so just for those of you who are not specialists who are here, quickly, the basic background rules of Buckley versus Valeo. Spending limits, the Supreme Court said, limits on how much an individual, including a candidate, could spend, generally violate the First Amendment because they're a direct infringement on free speech, and because there's no direct connection between the spender and the candidate, there can't be justified an anti-corruption rationale, and the court rejected an equality rationale in Buckley for these kinds of limits. But the court in Buckley upheld a $1,000 limit on individual contributions, saying it imposed only a marginal restriction on free speech and was justified by anti-corruption or preventing the appearance of corruption. So that's the basic Buckley framework. Buckley itself was somewhat schizophrenic in part because it was drafted by committee and the different parts don't cohere with each other. The first Buckley cases were quite skeptical of regulation, including cases like Bilotti. The more recent cases, as I've written about, call them the New Deference Quartet. These are the cases since 2000. They showed an extreme amount of deference, and many of these cases depended upon Justice O'Connor's vote, and Justice O'Connor, of course, left the court by the time of Randall. I argued that the new deference cases were incoherent. The court was speaking the language of Buckley, but it appeared to be moving towards an equality rationale for campaign finance laws. There's a large influence of Justice Breyer's views. Justice Breyer had a concurring opinion in Shrink, Missouri, which was one of these cases. He also wrote about this in Act of Liberty. He talked about participatory self-government and suggested that the Supreme Court's admonition about rejecting equality as a rationale should not be taken seriously. In terms of the specific precedent on contribution limits, the Supreme Court said two things about the amount of contribution limits in the past. First, in Buckley, the court upheld a $1,000 limit, saying there was no scalpel for choosing between, say, $1,000 and $2,000. And in Shrink, Missouri, the court upheld a $1,075 limit, which was indexed to inflation per election. Importantly, the court imposed a very deferential test. How do you know when a contribution limit is too low? The court said it has to be so low as to drive the candidate's voice below the level of notice and render contributions pointless, which was a pretty toothless test. And many of us said under that test, no contribution limit could be struck down. Okay, so now on to Randall. Randall, you had a holding on the spending limits and a holding on the contribution limits. On the spending limits, six justices reaffirmed that spending limits are unconstitutional, rejected the idea that spending limits would be justified by time preservation, less time raising funds. Of course, if you could get $1 million contribution from one person in Vermont, you wouldn't need to spend any time raising funds after that. The court rejected time preservations. Two justices wouldn't have reached the issue. Only Justice Stevens would have upheld the spending limits. On the contribution limits, we end up with this 3-3-3 split. So I'll take Justice Alito for 200. You have three of the justices. Ginsburg's, is this to your left? I guess, yes. So the three justices in the left-hand column, Ginsburg, Souter, and Stevens would stick with the new deference, and they would say, unless the limits are laughably low, whatever that means, they should be upheld. All the way over here to the right, you have the deregulationists, Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy. Kennedy is slightly less in the deregulationist camp. He's still expressing some agony, but Thomas and Scalia are strongly in that camp. They would strike down all contribution limits as violating the First Amendment, which leaves the plurality in the middle, the three-justice opinion of written by Breyer, joined by Roberts, and joined by Alito in part, and I'm going to talk about that in part in a minute. And it's the plurality opinion that's controlling. The plurality said sometimes limits are going to be too low as to be unconstitutional if the limits inhibit political competition. And the court enunciated a two-part test, which in Pam Carlin's paper, which I read on the plane, she says may be not really a two-part test, and I think that may be right. Are there danger signs that the risk of the political process in terms of decreased competition are too high? If so, is the measure closely drawn, or is it too restrictive given the anti-corruption goals it's trying to accomplish? And so, typical Justice Breyer technocratic fashion, you get five facts that the court uses to determine that there were danger signs. The Vermont limits applied per election cycle, not per election. They were very low compared to other amounts the courts upheld as adjusted for inflation. The amounts were low compared to other states. No state had a limit lower. So that's how they got through the first part. And then the court exercised independent judgment. And this is the key part for me. The court focused on expert testimony that suggested that the limits were too low in competitive races to run effective campaigns. The court also talked about political parties being subject to the very low limits and treated all the political parties, all the Democratic parties for organizations as a single entity. Costs associated with volunteer activities counted towards the limits, no adjustment for inflation, and no evidence of special corruption problem in Vermont. Therefore, the limits are unconstitutional. Okay, so my first, as I said, I have 4 points. The first point is this is a shift. If all you have to do is read Shrink Missouri and Randall, and you can see that this is not the same court. Shrink Missouri spoke repeatedly of deference to legislative judgments and to the expertise of legislatures. That was absent. Shrink Missouri is barely mentioned. Randall harkened back to Buckley. In Shrink Missouri, Justice Breyer said that Buckley's rejection of the equality rationale cannot be taken literally. In Randall, the court, in describing Buckley, doesn't even mention the equality rationale. It marks a shift away from deference. And let me mention Justice Alito's concurrence. Justice Alito said, I'm doing this, joining this opinion on the assumption that Buckley is still good law, but please, someone file a lawsuit and claim that stare decisis should not be followed. And so it's not clear how long Randall stands. It could be that Alito is going to quickly move into the deregulationist camp, and I think, as Ned Foley's pointed out, there's a good reason to think that Roberts could be moving there as well, which might cause Justice Kennedy to move to the middle column or somewhere. So ultimately, we may end up with a different alignment on the court on this issue. Okay, second point, Randall's not an embrace of the political markets approach. Sam and Rick have argued for this political markets approach, a structural approach that says that, among other factors, the court should ensure that the election system is sufficiently competitive. And then Rick, in a post on SCOTUS blog, which I don't, immediately after the opinion, which he may have no longer agree with. I know I post a lot of things that I immediately... You still agree with it? Okay. He praised it as showing the court moving into the structural role of protecting the political process so that there's adequate competition. I don't think that, that's a good reading of Randall. First, of course, we're going to set out political competition. The first place we'd see it is in the gerrymandering cases, but first in Veith and then reaffirmed in Lulock. There's no majority to police gerrymandering. It's not as if they didn't have the idea before them. In fact, they had Rick and Sam and Bert's brief, which said, use the elections clause. Here's a great textual hook to start policing competition. We're no closer to that holding. In fact, we're closest to a holding that these claims are wholly non-justiciable. The ballot access cases, as I've argued, also don't show the court moving towards promoting competition. Timmons said you can really favor the two-party system over third parties. Klingman spoke the language of some kind of stricter scrutiny, but if you look at how they actually applied the test, a lot of deference, not a concern about competition. In the campaign finance cases, if you read the cases, Buckley and the other cases, competition does not really come up as the central organizing theme. McConnell, in fact, rejected the idea that put forward by Justice Scalia that this was an incumbent protection scheme and said, no, in fact, the standard of review takes into account any possible self-dealing. And then, most importantly, Randall itself didn't apply the competition, anti-competition principle across the board. So when the court talked about spending limits, the court could have looked at what Justice Stevens pointed out in his opinion, in his dissenting opinion, which was that spending limits in Albuquerque, which were in effect for 15 years, seemed to actually promote political competition. And yet, there's no discussion about whether or not spending limits should be constitutional or should not be constitutional on the basis of whether or not they promote competition. There's a big debate in political science over whether spending limits would help or hurt challengers. This debate was ignored. So the Randall anti-competition test was for contribution limits only, joined by only 2.5 justices, and not clear that it's the test that's going to withstand any kind of time on the court. My suspicion is that the competition test was used as a rearguard action by Justice Breyer to write a minimalist opinion hewing to one side of Buckley in order to prevent Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito from going to the deregulationist position. That is, Breyer was able to take a line out of Buckley, which was concerned about competition, and use that as a basis for striking this down, but not going so far as to move into saying that contribution limits are generally unconstitutional. Third point of my four, The test that has been put forward to determine whether contribution limits are too low as to be unconstitutional, that test is unworkable. So the plurality makes an empirical assumption. This is a quote from the court. Contribution limits that are too low can harm the electoral process by preventing effective challengers, by preventing challengers from mounting effective campaigns against incumbent office holders, thereby reducing democratic accountability. Right, so the idea is contribution limits, if they're too low, you're not going to have appropriate amount of competition. And then the court envisions political scientists coming in and testifying as to the effects of limits on competitiveness. So, for example, I was just able to, since I wrote this draft, I was able to get a hold of the expert testimony in the case. So you had the political scientists get up there from the challengers, and he said, look, I've looked at the amounts that people gave. So here, this person gave $2,000 under the new limits. The person could give only $400. That's $1,600 that would be out of the system, and the amounts would be too low to run an effective campaign in a competitive election. The plurality latched onto this testimony and criticized Vermont's expert for looking at average races. He said, no, you have to look at the most competitive races. So what's the problem with this? There's an endogeneity problem. That is, the court seems to be assuming that the amount of money affects competitiveness without realizing that it's a more complex relationship. Spending limits affect competitiveness, and competitiveness affects spending. So, for example, these are points that Alan Gerber has made. As the probability of victory rises, it's easier for a candidate to raise money. If the election looks close, contributors are more likely to contribute. If the incumbent is insured of victory, she scales back on funding. And so it's very difficult to determine whether competitiveness is driving spending or when spending is driving competitiveness. This is a chart from the Milo Primo Gross Close article in the Marketplace of Democracy book that's coming out. Just it's a little blurry here, but just showing you some of the relationships that go actually in two directions if you're trying to figure out. It's actually a very difficult question. And in fact, the existing social science literature today, I think it's, from my read of it, it's inconclusive, but it seems to suggest, and I'm especially persuaded by the recent analysis of Milo, Primo, and Grossclose, who are no friends of campaign finance reform, that contribution limits, if anything, do not decrease competitiveness and might increase competitiveness. Also, Jacobson, writing on House races post-BICRA, said, look, the limits were doubled, but yet we didn't see an increase in competitiveness. And so it's clear that there's not at least a linear relationship between the amount of contribution limits and competitiveness, and it's actually a much more complex relationship. Most importantly, I think this idea about look at the amount of money that was given before, how much is going to be taken out of the system, ignores what I call the adaptation phenomenon. What happens when money's taken out of the system? Well, then you look to attract new money. And this is exactly what happened for the parties in BICRA. In BICRA, the parties could no longer collect soft money, but now they could collect hard money from more individuals. And in fact, after BICRA passed, the parties collected more in hard money alone than they collected in hard money and soft money under the old system. And so, in fact, if there is this kind of adaptation, this kind of testimony that all of this money is going to be cut is going to be very hard to justify as a way for determining how competitive elections are going to be. Okay, finally, so where does that leave us? It's going to be a battle of the experts. The one expert's going to get up there and testify the amounts are too low to prevent competition. The other expert's going to testify and say, no, there's enough here in order to run a competitive campaign. And that may have actually been what happened in Randall, because if you look at Randall, there was evidence from one race in Vermont that was, in fact, competitive under these limits. It was the race for mayor in Burlington, and the court said, well, there's not, this was just discussed briefly, there's not enough evidence. In fact, if you look at the record, there was plenty of evidence there that the race was competitive, and there was evidence in the experts' report from Vermont of other competitive races that were run under the limits. So the judges can use this test that the plurality's put out as a post hoc rationalization for striking down limits they don't like, or if you're a judge and you like contribution limits, say, oh, I think there's enough evidence here of competition, I'm not going to strike these down. So what's the alternative? I think the alternative is that the court be a little more honest about what's going on. Judge Calabresi, in his concurring opinion in the dissent of denial of rehearing on Bonk, if I have that right, in the Second Circuit, said that everyone's ignoring the elephant and donkey in the room, which is that this is all about political equality. This is not about competition. Vermont enacted these limits to promote political equality and to test Buckley. And the question should have been, was this measure justified on political equality grounds? And as I've argued elsewhere, I think the court should defer on value judgments to promote political equality, but then carefully determine whether the measure is narrowly tailored, and then if it is, ask, are the First Amendment costs too high? That's what I think the judges are doing anyway, but it would be better to engage in that in a more forthright way. And if that were done in this case, I think that maybe the court got it right, and in fact, these measures should be struck down, the Vermont measure should be struck down as unconstitutional. There were very high First Amendment costs here. For example, if you were a volunteer and you served coffee and donuts to people to talk about a state candidate, that was going to be counted against these limits. Political parties couldn't even aggregate a large number of $1 contributions towards political action. So social science can be relevant in this difficult balancing by looking at things like, would the limits be so low as to prevent robust political debate? Was there enough money to, say, put ads on television in Vermont, to put ads in newspapers, to send out mailings? Did people have a vigorous competitive the ability to get a message out to the electorate? Not that it's necessarily going to lead to a competitive campaign, but that there is a vigorous amount of political speech. And social science can help answer that question much more easily than it can answer the question, how much money is necessary to run a race where actually a challenger can beat an incumbent. It might be, in fact, that laws that are intended to promote political equality can't be justified unless they add more speech rather than just level down and limit speech, as this Vermont law was meant to do. How would that add to coherence? What I think it would do is we would have the judges more explicitly discuss what's going on, how they're engaged in the balancing. You're not going to have a Stevens and a Thomas agree, but at least we would know what the debate is about. They wouldn't be hiding behind the language of corruption, and I think that transparency itself would add coherence. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Richard for the sequel, which is Wisconsin Right to Life, the newest incoherence, which is, I think, going to be maybe at the Supreme Court this term. If not, it should make it to the Supreme Court by the next term.
Not sure whether I don't have any slides. I don't know whether to stand or sit, but why don't we start by sitting. And I do want to recommend Rick's very fine paper. There is obviously a fair amount of overlap both in content and in critique in his paper and mine. I'm going to, in my comments now, I'm going to try and focus on the things that are don't overlap, that are different. What I'm going to focus on and spend a little bit more time is the case that Rich has referred to. Really, it's the prequel, not the sequel. It's the forgotten election law case of the Roberts Court, the first election law case of the Roberts Court, the one in which the turn in campaign finance, in which the turn from deference to regulation to away from that, whether it's a stopping point or a turning point, remains unclear. The case in which, for the first time in a decade, the court did not support the pro-regulation position, a case known as Wisconsin Right to Life versus FEC, hereinafter WRTL. I'll also talk about Randall, time permitting, but I'm going to start with WRTL, which was decided with Chief Justice Roberts, but also with Justice O'Connor. This was a transitional case decided in late 2006, which really took on what is, to me, the most difficult issue in the area of campaign finance law, which is drawing the line between elections and politics, between electioneering and political speech. It's a question that affects not the content of campaign finance regulation, but the scope. And it shows up in many areas. It shows up with disclosure. And in particular, it shows up with respect to the longstanding limits on corporate and union expenditures. As you may recall, in the McConnell case in 2003, the Supreme Court upheld the provisions in BICRA that – maybe I'll wait till that goes up. Okay. For you pod people out there, that was the screen going up. In McConnell, the Supreme Court upheld the provision of BICRA in which Congress created a category called electioneering communications, thereby extending out the scope of regulable speech. And the key features of electioneering communications are broadcast communications that refer to a candidate and are aired within a pre-election period, 30 days before a primary, 60 days before a general election. This was a significant extension of the scope of regulatable of electioneering, which the Supreme Court on a 5-4 vote upheld, in part because the court concluded that most ads that would be picked up, that fit that description, would be electioneering ads, and in part because the court concluded that the corporations and unions that were affected by this could avoid the ban by either changing the timing of the ad, changing the media of the ad, this only applies to broadcast, avoiding references to candidates, or using a PAC. In the WRTL case, WRTL, Wisconsin Right to Life Group, wanted to air ads calling on voters in Wisconsin to contact their senators, Feingold and Cole, to ask them to stop judicial filibustering in the Senate. This was, of course, they wanted to air it, though, during the pre-election blackout period at a time when Senator Feingold was running for re-election. And they claimed that McConnell was only a facial judgment and that they were asking for an as-applied ruling that their ads, which, although they fell within the statutory description, were really grassroots lobbying and not electioneering. District Court rejected it, saying McConnell's language upholding BICRA in all the electioneering communications part of BICRA in all its applications meant that there could be no claim brought. In addition, the District Court concluded, based on the facts, that these ads were really electioneering, that they were part of a broader anti-Feingold campaign. The case goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in a brief, maybe why it's gotten so little attention, a 5-paragraph per curiam opinion, reversed and said simply McConnell is only facial. An as-applied challenge is should be considered. The court, of course, said nothing about the merits of the WRTL claim against Feingold and said gave no guidance as to what would constitute an as-applied challenge. Seems like not much to say about this, but it actually gets quite interesting. In part, if you look at the oral argument, the surface unanimity of this very brief judgment is belied by the intense division in the questioning, which suggests a continued adherence to the very tight division in McConnell, which was then 5-4. Chief Justice Roberts, in his first, I believe, questioning in connection with a campaign finance case, was unremittingly hostile to the government. The government's lawyer, the Solicitor General, had barely opened his mouth and he was hammered with questions about the government's position. The Chief Justice was bolstering WRTL's position on the facts. This seemed to be the McConnell majority justices were saying, didn't we do this in McConnell? The dissenters were very aggrieved at the First Amendment implications. And in the end, I think the court came up with a compromise, to me suggested by a question of Justice O'Connor, of saying, well, we didn't preclude an as-applied challenge, but we're not going to say anything about whether this one prevails. And so further thinking about this, the case has been remanded. There was just an oral argument in the remand about 2 weeks ago. A couple of other cases have emerged since then. One thing that strikes you in thinking about the grassroots lobbying exception is how difficult it's going to be to do. I think the call for an as-applied exception resembles the creation of an as-applied exception to the corporate ban that the court created in Massachusetts Citizens for Life, MCL, for ideological corporations. There, the court was able to generate criteria that did create a class of distinct ideological corporations that don't present the dangers that the court found in business corporations and that justify the business corporation ban. I don't believe it's possible to come up with a distinction that says there are one category of pre-election statements that mention both candidates and issues and that those are electioneering, and that there's another category of pre-election statements that combine references to candidates and issues, and those are grassroots lobbying. I think that it's going to be very, very difficult to come up with criteria that really separate these into two distinctive and determinate classes. I see three possibilities. One is that in practice, the as-applied application will be quite minimal, and indeed, the two courts that have had full-fledged hearings on this so far, I guess one was they're both preliminary injunction hearings, have rejected it, and one of those courts ultimately rejected it on the merits on mootness grounds. There could be some rarities. I think that in one of the cases involving ads that were being aired concerning the Marriage Protection Amendment and Senator Snow, I would have probably created an exception because she was unopposed in the primary, and maybe you could come up with a rarity that says you're entitled to an as-applied exception if you don't have an opponent. I think that that's one where the election regulation value seems slim and the burden on speech seems high. But beyond that, I think it's going to be very hard to do that. So either it's going to be minimal in practice or it's going to be maximal. The theory presented by the WRTL lawyers in the case would basically have eaten up the electioneering communications rule, as was a proposal that the FEC considered, a proposed interim final rule that failed of adoption by 3-3, and I can go through the criteria, but basically the way in which it was stated, virtually any ad that mentioned an issue would have been exempt, including an issue not in front of Congress or the President, but which might come before Congress or the President. So that I think you would have eaten up the exception. Third possibility, which you actually see the district courts doing in these cases, is a very close examination of the context, the history of the organization, its relationship to the candidate, the timing of the ad relative to the issue. Is the issue really being debated in Congress right now? The ad's relationship to the organization's electoral program. What is the ad really about? Which I think is actually what the district courts have been doing. This strikes me as an impossible test, one that is very hard to do in the limited time available. These things almost always come up on the eve of or right in the beginning of the blackout period, and is obviously open to arbitrary and capricious administration. So it'll be curious to see what happens with this. As Rick pointed out, the case has now been re-argued. It could go back to the court. So far, nothing has happened. But it could be that either nothing will happen or we'll have this open-ended discretionary mess, or this will be the basis for, in effect, reopening and ultimately and effectively undoing McConnell. The image that comes to my mind on this is the loose thread on the sleeve. You could either snip it off, or if you tug on it, the whole sleeve unravels. And I think that the question McConnell, if this does go back to the court, the question that McConnell answered may very easily be reopened. So that was WRTL, a little case, and there are those, I don't know if I would say that I love it, but there are a little case for those who find it interesting, maybe just me. The rest of my time I'm going to spend on Randall, again trying to not to repeat what Rick's very fine paper. First point, of course, is the point about fragmentation in the court in Randall. I would actually go further and say it wasn't a 3-3-3 fragmentation, but again, it's going to be hard to do this, and I apologize to the pod people out there. It's a 1-2-2-1-1-2 fragmentation in the court on the basic issues of campaign finance regulation, with Justice Stevens over here saying the First Amendment isn't even relevant, that money is so not speech that First Amendment analysis doesn't apply. Justices Souter and Ginsburg saying we're willing to regulate expenditures as well as contributions. Justices Breyer and Roberts, based on their votes, and we'll get to more of that later, saying we will not regulate expenditures, we will regulate contributions, but we're going to apply the test developed in Randall, which we'll get to in a second. Justice Alito, who votes with them, but as Rick pointed out, reserves judgment on the stare decisis effect of Buckley. In effect, what you've got Breyer and Roberts is basically saying Buckley continues with this a little modification. Alito says, I'm reserving judgment on that. Kennedy, who has been critical of the contribution expenditure distinction in the last several years, I would almost say cranky about it, but who has declined to say that he would go further and prohibit contribution regulation. And Scalia and Thomas, who, starting with Justice Thomas in the 1990s, have consistently concluded that burdens on contributions should be subject to the exact same review as burdens on expenditures and should be as equally as unconstitutional. So you really have this rather extreme fragmentation of the court. I think the 1-2-2-1-1-2 does turn into 3-3-3. I'm not disagreeing, but you can actually see that the fissures are even more widespread. Again, for me, the point for Randall is the reaffirmation and the simultaneous reaffirmation and, if not destruction, challenge to the contribution expenditure distinction, which is the heart, which once you get past saying that campaign finance regulation is subject to the First Amendment review, is the heart of Buckley, the contribution expenditure distinction, which has been the court's doctrine for 30 years now. You now have, not the first time, but you now have a majority of the court repudiating it, but of course you don't have a majority for an alternative. What I found interesting in the case, among many things, is how, in this case, the doctrinal divide actually gets encoded in a stylistic divide. In the cases, this is in the plurality opinion. Again, there's multiple opinions, and I'm focusing, on Justice Kennedy and Lulak, I'm focusing on a slightly bigger group, the plurality, which consists of Breyer, Roberts, and part of the time, Alito. What's striking, just the way the opinion is written, is the stylistic divide. Expenditure limits, not only is the result different, well, actually here is the result is the same, the analysis is different, but the whole style of writing is different. On the expenditure limits, the plurality opinion by Justice Breyer is totally formalistic. It doesn't engage with the Vermont the law at all. The details of the Vermont law are not mentioned. The merits of the case for spending limits are not mentioned. The merits of the case against spending limits are not mentioned. There's no discussion of the reasoning of Vermont or of the Second Circuit and how the Second Circuit was able to come up with a theory that you could have spending limits consistent with Buckley. The Second Circuit had two ideas, two arguments for that. One is not mentioned at all. The other one is rolled up in this court's general stare decisis discussion, and indeed the plurality's, stare decisis discussion. And indeed the plurality says this is a head-on challenge to Buckley, which the Second Circuit had said it was not. And so the plurality opinion is really a paean, a tribute to stare decisis, and that stare decisis should be the rule here, and we see no reason to reopen the rule in Buckley. And they say something which I think is truly a howler, they being Justice Breyer again. One reason not to reopen stare decisis here is because in the 30 years since then, Congress and the state legislatures have come to rely on Buckley. Now, reliance is a good argument to use when people are adopting laws based on a judicial doctrine. But when you've got a judicial doctrine which is preventing certain laws and legislatures are relying on that by not adopting laws, it strikes me as an ironic, if not cynical, use of the notion of reliance. There's no substantive argument for the Buckley rule. It's purely, we did this before. And interestingly, the three concurring justices, Kennedy, I guess it's four on this point because Alito doesn't join most of this opinion. He just joins the result because he doesn't see this as stare decisis. Kennedy, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas, they actually don't get into the merits either. I guess it was Rick's point about everyone seems tired of this. They just seem bored by the issue. The issue just seems to have been pre-resolved and not worthy of attention, even though this was the issue that caught, I guess, the interest of the election law community as the case was going up. And instead, the case becomes one about the contribution limits. And then again, it's stylistically totally different. Stare decisis is not mentioned. Earlier cases are mentioned, but they're given not much weight. It's totally substantive. Great discussion of the details of the ins and outs of the law and of the interactions of the different parts of the law. Great discussion of the costs and benefits of regulation, particularly on the cost since the law is knocked out, but at least some reference to the benefits of it. Great discussion of substantive values, including the substantive value which is added here, and I probably give more weight to it than Rick does, which is the value of competitiveness, which I think became central. Rick has an extensive discussion of competitiveness in his paper, which I commend to you. I just want to make four points about the way in which the court does this. One is, and maybe I'm overstating this, it seems to be the disappearance of the First Amendment. In this classic First Amendment arena. The problem of contributions is taken by Breyer to be a problem of competition, this structural issue. It's a issue of the ability of candidates to present themselves against other candidates, the possibility of challengers replacing incumbents. I suppose you could think of the candidates as having First Amendment rights, but the feel of it, and I don't mean that sarcastically, of course candidates have First Amendment rights, but the feel of it is very much in line with the sort of the market's structural turn. The only time you get something close to a First Amendment argument is the reference to the associational rights of parties. But that's in the context of Breyer's argument that parties are a key factor in promoting competitive elections. So it struck me that you have a feel about competitiveness here. Second is the way in which the court the plurality defines competitiveness, which of course it's done unselfconsciously. Competitiveness is defined entirely as the ability of challengers to displace incumbents. Other possible definitions of competitiveness, which in here I've alluded to something that Nate Persily's piece in the Marketplace of Competition, that can't be the title of it, the samples book that's coming out, refers to things like rates of contestation, in other words, how many incumbents actually get challengers, as opposed to the many elections which we have where nobody runs against the incumbent, and margins of victory. Those are possible, and I think some of the literature on contribution restrictions suggests that at least more likely in those areas, contribution restrictions are likely to be pro-competitive, or at least there's some evidence. And I also agree that there's lots of dueling studies in this area, and there's probably no conclusive evidence on any of this. But at least a plausible argument that in some areas, contribution restrictions can promote competitiveness, even if it may very well be that in the areas where you've got a competitive challenger who needs that extra boost of money to catch up to the incumbent, it's possible that contribution limits might be harmful. So very much focused on its own definition of competitiveness and not thinking about it more broadly. So that's the second point, the first being competitiveness is central. Third point is the fact of low numbers. Much of what appears to trigger this is the danger signal that triggers the very close analysis is the low numbers of the Vermont law. And absolute dollars, they are low compared to those federal law, most states, and the cases the courts have had before. Well, the plurality raises and then dismisses is the significance of the fact of the small size of the Vermont constituencies. Vermont is our 49th largest state. It has Its state senate is third from smallest. Its state house is second smallest. And the lower house in particular is quite large. The lower house of the Vermont legislature is nearly twice the size of the lower house of the California legislature. And it is bigger than the lower house of the Ohio legislature and the same size as the lower house of the New York legislature. What is the result of that? The average constituency in the lower house of the Vermont legislature is 4,000 people. The average constituency in the state senate is 20,000. If contribution limits have a nexus to competitiveness, it has to be something to do with how contribution limits affect the ability of candidates to collect money to then go out and communicate with voters. And it would seem that if there are very few voters, if there's no use of mass media, if it's also territorially small, and Vermont is the 45th state in terms of territory, so you don't have to have expensive transportation, it is possible to think that you could get away with competitive elections with very small constituencies with relatively low numbers. And then did I do the relationship? If you take the contributions cap ratio to the size of constituency ratio as a figure, the Vermont limits are actually more generous than the federal limits for the House of Representatives, for 31 of the 50 U.S. Senate, U.S. states for Senate races, and for the presidency. Luckily for the federal limits, the plurality opinion dismisses the significance of this relationship. But if anybody ever actually thinks that this relationship is significant, then the federal limits are in deep trouble. Final point in the discussion of the plurality opinion is the plurality's focus on the party limits, which, as Rick pointed out, are the same as the contribution limits for individuals and are also very low. And that the same lowness does, I think, make them unique in regulatory system. And I think in any American jurisdiction. And there I think Justice Breyer is right, given the evidence on the key role of the parties in channeling funds in competitive races. I think I'm carping a lot about the plurality opinion here. That's my job, I guess. But here the carping point has to do with why didn't they just sever the limits on the parties, which is what the district court did. In this case, the district court upheld the contribution limits on individuals, struck down the limits on expenditures as precluded by Buckley, upheld the limits on contributions to the parties, which are actually fairly generous, $2,000, and then struck down the limits on party contributions, and also did so by looking at both the Vermont Code and Vermont case law, which prefers severance over invalidation of a full law because they prefer to keep whatever is constitutional. The plurality opinion has a phrase that says, we prefer not to do severance because it could create a gaping loophole in the Vermont law. But of course, by striking down the whole law, that's exactly what they did, because the pre-existing Vermont law did have limits on contributions, but the Vermont law before 1997 had no limits on parties. So Vermont now has relatively generous limits on individuals and no limits on parties, which is pretty much what you would have gotten from severance. So it's a question for me. A final point on this, there's much of value in the Breyer opinion. Competition is important. The reformers' obsession with removing money from politics, I think, is deeply misguided. Candidates need money. Challengers really need money. Parties do play a particularly valuable role in promoting competition. We should protect volunteers, not cause them to account for their donuts. There probably should be separate ceilings for primary and general elections, because Vermont had a cycle ceiling, which I think is pro-incumbent, although not always. There should be indexing, which Vermont did not do. Breyer's opinion is full of good ideas, and they would be a model for a campaign code, but the opinion is terrible judicial decision-making. It's open-ended. Everything counts. Nothing counts. It's an open-ended, indeterminate, incoherent standard for future courts and for lawmakers. All the lawmakers need to do, I suppose they could follow all the rules, but as a standard, it's very unclear. Just a couple more points. One is the final point of this is, where do we go from here? Where is the law now? If you think of the four big areas of campaign finance regulation, one is disclosure. That's not affected. McConnell upheld rather extensive disclosure by a vote to 8-1. That doesn't change. And indeed, in the oral argument in Randall, both Roberts and Kennedy spent a lot of time saying, well, if corruption is the problem, the solution is for the voters to vote out the people who take big contributions or spend a lot of money. That implicitly, I think, is a support for disclosure. Contribution limits, I think, is where we're not clear. As I say, we now have most of the court is against the expenditure contribution divide. It's not clear there's a majority to get rid of contribution limits. There are clearly four in favor, the three dissenters here plus Breyer, who clearly is staking out a position of trying to save contribution limits, possibly by his tribute to Stare Decisis, was hoping to lock in Roberts and Alito. Alito clearly announced he was not locked in. Roberts said nothing. Roberts joined the opinion, didn't disclaim it. Roberts, in oral argument, was very critical of Vermont's law, but mostly on the expenditure side. There was almost no space between him and Breyer in terms of his comments. It could very well be that Roberts felt he didn't have to say anymore, and that he could do more the next time, or not. I'm not enough of a tea leaf reader, but I find him sort of profoundly Delphic on this point, and so I don't think we really know the answer on contribution limits. What I think is most vulnerable are the longstanding limits on corporations and unions. The limits on corporations in federal elections is the oldest campaign finance law we have. The election law, Lister pointed out recently, we're approaching the 100th anniversary of the Tillman Act. But I think it's hanging by a thread. The McConnell vote sustaining the electioneering communications, extension of the corporate ban to electioneering communications was by 5-4. Remove O'Connor and Rehnquist, it's now 4-3. If you look at if one can read anything out of Roberts' very hostile comments in the oral argument in WRTL, it's back to 4-4, him replacing Rehnquist. Where Alito is, we have very little to read, but I suspect he might be skeptical. Now again, and moreover, the only case that upheld these things, the ban on corporate expenditures, Austin, doesn't fit easily with the Buckley model, so to say the least. So I suspect this is one that's hanging by a thread. If WRTL comes back, it may be that it comes back not so much to drive a hole into McConnell, but to drive a hole into the restrictions on corporate, or to eliminate the restrictions on corporations generally. Again, I don't know, but it strikes me as more than contribution limits, the longstanding ban on corporations is in danger. Finally, and this really is a finally, public funding. The other arrow in the campaign finance quiver. As a reform strategy, it becomes more imperative. If limits are under stress, and clearly they are, the contribution limits may survive, they may survive as pruned back, they may not survive, then public funding has what public funding has going for it is it's not a limit, it's a subsidy. It's consistent with First Amendment values, it's consistent with competition, if competition is central. Public funding at least is pro-competitive, or at least has the potential, depending, of course, on how it's done, of being pro-competitive, putting money into the hands of candidates, particularly those who need it the most, challengers. It was upheld in Buckley by a wide margin. There are no Supreme Court decision since has challenged it. For my money, it's good policy, although I know there are those who disagree, but I also think it's constitutionally safe as law. Only 3 minutes over.
I think everybody can see me from here, so I think this will probably work. I want to thank Ned and all the folks at Ohio State for inviting me here and putting on what's really a great symposium. I'm feeling very disappointed that I actually am going to be out of town leaving first thing in the morning and not able to be here tomorrow as well, but I'm glad I've been able to be here today, and I hope you all have appreciated as well. I was thinking about this. We were going on, Rick joked a little bit about Richard speaking even faster than he did, and I'm reminded my old colleague at the Federal Election Commission, Danny Lee McDonald, used to always complain when we had time limits that he should get more time because he spoke slower than the rest of us. And I thought that was an interesting observation because that really does go to the problem of trying to use equality as a defining principle for how much people should be allowed to speak. You can define equality in many, many different ways. I really enjoyed the papers by the two Ricks, I'll call them, from time to time. I think they're both very much worth reading. I found myself feeling a little bit like I didn't have a lot of specific comments relating to those papers, in part because I think they both analyzed the cases very well. They're complementary but raised some different points. I learned some thoughts or had some new perspective on the two opinions from reading each of them. But in the end, the big difference then between me and they, or whatever the grammatical construction would be, is that is a fundamental assumption, and it's this assumption about the legitimacy of equality as an organizing constitutional principle within the First Amendment. I tend to be of the belief generally that it simply is not a workable principle within the First Amendment. And I believe ultimately that you cannot have a sort of a balancing act on equality and protect the fundamental core of the amendment. I believe, in fact, that the amendment's purpose is largely to prevent exactly that discussion from taking place, to keep the government out of the business of deciding who has spoken too much, who needs to be speaking more, who we've heard enough from, whose message is illegitimate, and whether or not candidates should be required to say, I approve this ad. I think that's the purpose of the First Amendment, is to kind of keep the government out of those particular decisions. And I think as an enforcement matter, you simply are not going to be able to have an equality rationale that works. I think that Rick Hazen is quite right in suggesting that equality has been behind a lot of the opinions in recent years, even though it hasn't been openly discussed. And McConnell, of course, gives great deference to that, and through its deferential approach and its kind of redefining of corruption as this kind of, well, distortion, really, it allows for a lot of equality interest. And I think what we've seen is by no means pretty. Now, it's only a couple of election cycles, but we've seen since McConnell what I would say is all hell break loose. We see the states going at one another, the parties engaging in partisan jockeying to regulate the other side. We see that at the federal level. It's sort of the war of all against all that, again, I think the First Amendment was intended to prevent. And McConnell, I think, shows us that the deferential approach is really something of a dead end, because these problems are not easily resolved. I mean, there's the 527 issue, and that Justice Breyer dismissingly, cavalierly waved away, and I mean literally waved away at oral argument, waved his hand like this when it was brought up. In fact, it was brought up in the context he'd been grilling Judge Starr about Joe Wealthy was his hypothetical, and then the plaintiff's lawyer, Bobby Birchfield, came up, and he opened his argument by saying, Justice Breyer, Joe Wealthy is George Soros, who just has pledged to spend $10 million to win this case. And Breyer, this is when he actually waved his hand and he said, well, we'll see about that. I don't think there's any evidence that that's going to be a big loophole, why he wouldn't be able to do that, and gave his argument why that would never occur under the law, that George Soros would be able to do that. But, you know, the thing is, the 527s are the easy part of the end result of McConnell. The harder part are other things we just begin to see popping up, things like the internet. You can spend a lot of money on the internet and you can spend very little money. But a lot of people who spend a lot of money on the internet spend a lot of money simply because their speech generates a lot of money. So Daily Kos, Marcos Moulitsas, who runs that blog, is spending now well into six figures a year to maintain his blog. But why is he spending six figures to maintain that blog? Well, he's spending six figures because people want to read the blog, so he needs the bandwidth. And in that respect, he's much like a newspaper or a television station. But are we going to say, well, he gets the press exemption? On what basis? On what basis do other people not get the press exemption? Simply because not as many people want to read their blog, but maybe they spend much less money on it. But still, they spend some money. And increasingly, blogs are incorporated, and we have an outright ban on incorporation. I don't want to go into all these in detail, but we haven't begun to touch the more difficult questions of movies and books, which are not even covered by the statutory press exemption. In theory, although nobody's ever chosen to prosecute them, movies and books are violations of the law if they are produced or published by corporations. And in fact, we have had, in the last cycle, several complaints filed, and the commission's position at the Federal Election Commission was, well, when it was a new filmmaker, we weren't going to let him do it. But if it was Michael Moore, well, I mean, this is at the Cannes Film Festival, for crying out loud, so, I mean, that's got to be legitimate. Right? I'm not sure that that's a very constitutionally stable basis for deciding who gets to make political movies and who does not. And this doesn't get to the even harder question, which is what to do about press bias, which is something that some of our panelists here today have had something to say about in the past. And I think in the end, you simply are not going to be able to have a system that is going to work if your idea is that legislatures can kind of do what they want as long as they're trying to balance and equal things out and can make some reasonable claim for doing that, because the legislature can almost always make some reasonable claim for doing that. So having said that then, where do I think that we are here? I guess I would say that, as I think my two colleagues have kind of hinted, that they would agree that the indications are that the Roberts Court is pretty sympathetic toward the kind of views that I have just summarized. But the question is, where would they go? The Roberts Court and election law, where might they go in the future? Would they really overturn Buckley v. Valeo and the limitations on contribution limits? I tend to think that they would not. The question would be, so far, for example, Scalia and Thomas have said that they would do that. Justice Kennedy, as has been pointed out, has never quite signed on to that. And he's not that kind of guy. It's just like in LULAC. He never quite says, well, you can never have a constitutional violation on gerrymandering, but he won't ever say that there's any case where you can. But he doesn't like to draw that hard and fast line and suggest that it should never occur. And you know, that's a caution that is probably not a bad trait in many, many ways. And of course, there's some question as to whether Roberts would go that far. It's been pointed out today that he's kind of a consensus guy and fairly cautious. Alito, I think, might be a little more likely to pass into that wing. And would they do that on a 5-4 vote overturning a law? Would they be comfortable with the idea, the hypothetical often posed to me, would you be comfortable if Bill Gates gave somebody $1 billion? And I think there's serious doubt that they would. And I think there's also serious doubt that such a regime would last without sparking a major move toward a constitutional amendment that might, in fact, finally gather enough steam to pass, because I think people are at some gut level uncomfortable with that. So what would be a more likely course that we might see within the Roberts Court? Well, first, we also need to consider that I think the deregulationary block is unlikely to be reinforced in the near future. Unless there's an opening on the court within the next 5 or 6 months, we're not going to see another appointment by this president. The next president, if it's a Democrat, there has been in recent years some rethinking of Democratic orthodoxy on this issue. But still, the orthodox position is that this type of regulation is a good idea and ought to be in place. And I think it's likely that any Democrat nominee would be more likely to support regulation in the area. On the Republican side, perhaps the most likely presidential nominee is John McCain, and he is probably the one person who would make it a litmus test. We would have a new litmus test for court justices that they had to agree to support campaign finance reform. So I think that would be a problem there. So it's fairly unlikely that there won't be reinforcements for the deregulationist group, even if some of the what we might call the new deference quartet, the four justices on the other side, were to be replaced. At the same time, the oldest of the deregulationary justices are just 70 years old, Kennedy and Scalia. That used to be considered a very old age, but nowadays, with modern medicine and so on, I think it's fair to say they both seem to be in good health and both could easily have 10 or 15 years on the court. I mean, we never know, but there's fairly good reason to think that there may be a fairly stable five-justice majority there for a strongly pro-First Amendment position, as I would prefer to call it. So what would then possibly take place? I think what we might find is that people might retreat a bit first to the Buckley regime. For all its faults, and its faults are many, Buckley also has much to commend it. Its distinction between contributions and expenditures I have criticized. I think there is much to criticize about it, both as a constitutional theory and in the practical effects it has on law. But it is not, as Richard mentions in his paper and I've seen elsewhere, it's not a distinction without some logic to it. Clearly there is a greater sense of a possible corruption where a person is sitting down in a meeting and handing somebody a $100,000 check for their campaign, then when they are operating, spending the money independently, and they do have to spend it independently, not in coordination. Clearly there is some difference between the two, and on that basis, at least the distinction can be somewhat justified. The other thing about the Buckley regime is that it actually was quite a stable regime. It was not a regime that some people liked, and they worked very, very hard over many years to destabilize it. But in fact, it was readily understood by practitioners, could be fairly easily explained to political candidates and political operatives and even to the general public, and had a body of law that was fairly stable. It allowed an awful lot of speech to go on, which I think under the First Amendment in our country is a good thing. But it did restrain, again, I think with some logic, that most obvious place for corruption, the direct large campaign contribution into a candidate. So I think that Buckley will begin to be seen perhaps as having some benefit, at least if I'm correct, that Justice Scalia and maybe Justice Roberts, maybe even Justice Alito, wouldn't really quite have the stomach to say Bill Gates or whomever, AT&T or whoever you want it to be, can give $1 billion. Not that they ever would, but that they could. We should point out as well, as we go to this, that there may be, I think, some other changes here. It's worth noting that The opinion in Randall v. Sorrell begins with a quote from the late 19th, early 20th century statesman Elihu Root, in which he talks about the need to rein in the big moneyed interest. And the court doesn't give us the whole speech, and they might have, because if they had, they would have seen that Elihu Root specifically said what he was talking about. He was talking about corporations giving $50,000 or $100,000 to a candidate. Now, this is 1894 he made this speech. So if we adjust that for inflation, he's talking about contributions by a company in excess of $1 million. And that's the low figure he gave that concerned him. That companies shouldn't be able to give more than $1 million. With the height at the peak of the soft money boom before McCain-Feingold, fewer than 20 companies in America, fewer than 20 corporations in the United States gave over $1 million in soft money contributions when they could do that. So I think that there is some reason to think that there might be some comfort with giving some corporations a bit more latitude. And the way to do that, I think, would be, or one way I think that would likely occur, would be through the overruling of Austin v. Michigan Chamber of Commerce. In fact, Austin really is the case that, at least prior to the New Deference Quartet, as Rick refers to them, was the case that kind of stood out as an anomaly in election law, the case, or in campaign finance law, the case that really didn't quite fit in with Buckley and Bellotti and some of the other cases. And if Austin were tossed out, Austin is the case that prohibits corporations from making direct corporate treasury expenditures, it would be a blow to the reform community, but it would not be quite so big a blow as they might think, because, of course, it would leave in place the ability to limit the amounts of money that corporations could, in fact, contribute to candidates. And those could be fairly low, $2,100, the same as the current individual limit. They could be $5,000, the same as the current PAC limit. It could be $102,000, the same as the current individual aggregate limit, or somewhere in between or somewhere around in there. So there would be room, in fact, for something to take place there and for some limits still to be placed on corporate giving. From an enforcement standpoint, this would be a wonderful thing because it would do away with a lot of the need for lawyers. It would do away with a lot of the minor violations that corporations have when a secretary runs off a letter on corporate letterhead, or when the corporation, which is actually legally allowed to endorse a candidate, actually spends $50 to produce a press release saying they endorse that candidate and so on. We would get rid of a lot of these kind of silly little things that are the result of the first dollar prohibition on corporate spending. The other thing I think that might happen would then be some pressure on contribution limits. There's some interesting question to me is, what does the public think is a large contribution? We know from polling data that the public is concerned about large contributions, but we know very little about what the public actually thinks is a large contribution. And it looks to me like some very early data, and I hesitate to even put this in a paper, but here orally at least I'll suggest it as a hypothesis anyway, is that what the public thinks is a large contribution is a heck of a lot more than $2,100. I think when the public hears a large contribution, they're thinking $25,000, $10,000, maybe $50,000 or $100,000. And in fact, many members of the public think those contribution levels occur because the reporting on the issue is so poor and there is so much misinformation out there. The other day on CNN, one of the announcers, after having the law carefully explained to him how corporations were not allowed to give, finally concluded, well, I think corporations still find a way to get that money in there, which is very helpful for a newscaster to say this. You know, he had no evidence, no basis for this. Otherwise, then I'll reinforce the conventional wisdom here rather than use my news broadcast to actually educate the public. But I think that if we look at that, we would say that the public in this kind of regime with no Austin, with a return to Buckley, and maybe with some upward pressure to raise contribution limits, would not be such a bad regime. It would be stable. It would allow a great deal of speech to go on. It would cut off what I think the public sees as the worst potential abuse, the one that really concerns the public. You know, the public has never shown tremendous concern about campaign finance. It never shows up as an issue that's on the top of people's minds. It's always at the very bottom, even when they're presented with a long list of issues to choose from. I don't know if it's one of the 16,000 least important problems, but I would say it's down there quite a ways. And this would allow the worst of that abuse to be headed off. It would allow quite a bit of speech to go on. And it
it would allow, I would point out, the equality rationale to still play a role through government subsidies without limits, a position long endorsed by the ACLU and one that I think Richard has generally endorsed. I'm not sure how much Richard wants limits with public subsidies for campaigns, but it would not preclude that role from playing in there in an effort to take advantage of the equality rationale. So if we're looking for a possible way that the Buckley or that the Roberts Court wanting to kind of deregulate but not having the stomach to truly deregulate in that Bradley Smith kind of crazy fashion might do, this would be a fairly strong way that they might do it over a course of several years. Thank you.
I want to thank the panelists. We're going to let the panelists make some response, if they'd like to each other, and then take questions. If there are people who are not sitting at the table who want to ask questions, there's a mic right here that you can come up. There's nobody sitting in that chair. So if you want to ask a question and you're not sitting at the table, just come up and get on that mic and we'll recognize you. Do any of you have comments that you want?
Hey, you know, I think there's, not normatively, but as a matter of prediction, I think there's a lot of convergence among the three of us on these points. And I was thinking about what Richard said about the different ways that the Wisconsin case could be decided. And it seems to me that if you buy into the idea that Chief Justice Roberts wants to go as minimalist as he can, consistent with following what he wants to do, driving a gaping hole through the electioneering communications provision in Wisconsin Right to Life would be a good step towards overruling Austin without actually having to overrule Austin. And that you bring all that issue advocacy back in, effectively achieve the overruling of Austin, at least as to these big ads, without having to say Austin's overruled. And so that could be and then when the world doesn't collapse when that happens, that's the setting the stage for the eventual overruling of Austin, which we could see from this court.
Just, I agree with a lot of what Brett said. I also think it could very well be the basis for the ruling of Austin and as a WRTL successor. It's quite interesting when you read McConnell, as although the issue of McConnell was the extension of the corporate immunity ban to electioneering communications, none of the four dissenters actually talk about the extension. They talk about the underlying ban. So there clearly are, there were four, now three, and quite possibly back up, the justices willing to knock out the underlying ban on corporate expenditures. So depending on how the question was taken, WRTL, if it gets back, we were talking at the break, and one of these other as-applied cases was just dismissed by the district court, and an interesting combined theory of mootness and lack of rightness. That is, the 2004 election is over, they don't have an ad pending in the next election, so there may indeed be some issues. The 2004 election in Wisconsin is over. They do have an ad pending, but that's in a separate case in the 2006 election. So it's not actually all that obvious whether that particular case will go, but I think the issue won't go away. I think the issue of limits of regulation remains a hard one, possibly more difficult. I think it's not possibly, certainly more conceptually difficult than exactly what we do. I also agree with you about the stability of Buckley. I mean, certainly descriptively, Buckley hasn't been stable for 30 years. It's stable and partly is a matter of experience. No one idea has beaten it. The more regulatory approach, which I think does assume a requirement of standard equality, has not created a majority of the court. Partly, I think there are real operational issues as to how it will be obtained, as well as some conceptual issues about what exactly RICO does it. Nor has the pure deregulatory position prevailed, partly because I think of the ongoing concerns about the undue influence of great wealth. I mean, we are trying to hold together a system based on political equality in a society marked by enormous inequality of wealth, and with a principle that is hostile to government regulation of the political process, which is the means by which we replace government. So we're trying to hold together both free and competitive elections with some respect for political equality in an equal society. And although I think there are many problems with the contributions manager distinction, I agree with the critics of it on the First Amendment side, I'll call it that, which point to the inevitable links between contributions and expenses. And practically, it has enormous difficulties. So many of the problems that people see in the current system
the frenzy of fundraising, meaning we have a system in which we have unlimited spending but capped contributions. So you have the frenzy of fundraising, you have the emergent role of intermediaries, PACs and funders to help collect those contributions, you have the rise, not necessarily the success, but the rise of self-funded candidates who are uncapped, and of course you have the relentless probing for loopholes and exceptions and the rise of uncapped organizations such as 527s. Having said all that, having said that there would be conceptual and pragmatic problems with the contribution expenditure distinction, it may very well be that in the effort to reconcile these irreconcilable values, it's a workable compromise. And for that reason alone, both its intrinsic value, whatever its problems, and the lack that it takes something to beat something, they very well be stable. I agree with you with some movement at the margins, such as either forcing up the standards
Yeah, I'd just be interested in the panelists' views on how stable they think the 5-4 holding is on the electionary communications provisions, not on the whole Buckley framework, but on those particular provisions. I mean, you've already suggested that perhaps the court could undermine the corporate and labor ban on paying for electionary communications by creating an as-applied exception, which is potentially huge. Do you think there's a possibility that the new Roberts Court could actually take on the issue heads on and challenge the conclusion in McConnell? Or do you think they'd likely shy away from that?
Throughout the courts and the lower courts as well, they seem to assume that 30-60-day electionary communications apply 90 days a year. But that's not really true, especially at the presidential level. It also applies 30 days before the convention, so we're up to 120 days a year. And many, many media markets are multi-state markets. And so our TV stations are serving more than 50,000 voters in multi-states, and the president, of course, is a candidate in each state. In many, many markets, we've done some survey data recently. I don't have the material in front of me. It's an article published next year in the Stanford Journal of Law and Policy, Law and Policy Review, whatever it's called. We note that in many media markets, it's well in excess of 200 days per year that you are browned out on running these ads. And so, you know, I think that there's ample basis for the court to do what would appear to be kind of a narrow holding just based on all the facts that have to be considered. They could even go further if they wanted to do so. I want to take one quick disagreement with something Richard said in his note. He said that the FEC proposal would have allowed virtually any ad that mentioned an issue to go in. It would have been something that would have allowed a lot of ads, but do remember there were a lot of restrictions on that. You couldn't mention a person's character. You could only cite his position in terms of votes or his own words. You couldn't mention that there was an election coming up. So there were a lot of restrictions, but it would have allowed you, if you wanted to do an issue ad, to be an awful lot.
Right. What I mentioned is that it's going to be any issue rather than an issue that's before Congress tomorrow. I think the language is that has as a subject matter a public policy issue under consideration by Congress and the executive branch, but the commentary from the proponent was that it would encompass not only a legislative proposal introduced in Congress as a bill, but also a proposal for concept that has not yet been introduced as a bill, as well as a matter of public debate which has or may engage Congress and the executive branch. So yes, if you refrain from rhetoric, or whether you devoted your rhetoric to the proposal, you could have extremely critical statements about the proposal, then say the senator is in favor of this proposal, call the senator up and tell him what you think. That's not very different, if at all different, from the kinds of issue ads that were talked about a couple of years ago when Bigger was coming through. It's different from the issue ads which were totally about slamming the candidate's personality. It's the, you know, stop eating your wife ads. Yes, it wouldn't pick that up, but I think it would pick up a lot. So that's that. You can narrow them down, but I think you probably could come up with one which is maybe a little more neutral. But if you think that any time you're linking advocacy of an issue to a candidate's position on the issue to taking to making a call, it looks a lot like the other ones, which is why I think. And depending on how you credit the dueling experts about how these things are perceived by voters, if you you take seriously the impact on voters, and I think it's hard to separate them. I think what this, but I do think that this gives the court, a different court, the chance to reconsider that very debated issue in multiple ways. I mean, one is Austin, to the contrary, notwithstanding, four members of the court in 2003 called for overruling Austin 13 years after his decision, so they didn't have that much stare decisis on that. So one is the most overwhelming would be the getting rid of Austin. The other would be overruling McConnell in the sense of, well, we overestimated the value of the alternatives to McConnell. And the court said, I think it was very surprising McConnell. The court really minimized the First Amendment burden and said, well, by the way, they could always avoid the 60-day period. They could stop before you were a candidate, the incumbent, rather than what we're talking about here. Or they could use their PAC in this strike, or they could stop using broadcasting. And these all strike me as basically saying they could give up their rights or do a more costly way. I think the heart of the matter was we think that these are mostly electioneering, and or maybe a positive disentangle with the electioneering from the others. I found the most troubling part of McConnell the idea that these are all good alternatives. To that extent, it's connected to the survival of Austin. One of the ways in which Austin holds up is the idea that spending through a PAC is just as good as using your treasury funds, and it avoids the abuse of the treasury and the abuse of dissenters. And in some ways, McConnell and Austin are closely linked. So maybe it's possible.
Let me just make a brief follow-up. I think Richard said the court can do anything, maybe it has the will to do, maybe it doesn't. There's a technical aspect that's, I think, Mike's paper, I don't know if you had a chance to read it yet, but the three-judge court, the technical aspect of this, which is that the use of the three-judge court forces the court to do something with the jurisdictional statement, and the summary affirmance is worth more, exactly how much more we don't know, but worth more than a cert denial. And so that, I think that's why Jim Bob is up at the Supreme Court every 5 minutes, because he's trying to get them to actually take one of these cases. So I think that as a smart litigator as Bob is, he's trying to use the three-judge court method to force the issue. So I think that's why I think it's going to take Wisconsin rights to like maybe two or three. It's going to happen relatively soon.
From a reformer's perspective, if they take, and I call this really Wisconsin right to life one, Wisconsin right to life two, if they take WRTL one, that's the best case for reform, for my money, because of the facts. That one is clear. It is clear to me, and I don't know if you would agree, that was an electioneering ad. Given what was said in it, the fact that the organization had attacked Feingold separately, the fact that they were attacking Feingold through their PAC, and I think to some extent the timing of Roberts and the oral argument is beautiful argument. They only read the ad during what was set up as a recess. As it happened, that was in the period it did, but in the summer, he said, well, that's a great time to do the end, Saturday's home. And therefore you can lobby, as opposed to acknowledging that, of course, that's the one time the Senate can't take up the issue. So I thought that was as clear an evidence of this view on this as anything. I think that the three cases that have been before the district court in the past year or so, that's the one with by far the worst facts for the as-applied exception. To me, the one that had the best facts is the one that just got dismissed as both not like that moot, which was the Olympia Snow one, because she was running out of post. And then there's yet another one where, maybe also very good for the exception, where it seems to be largely about the issue, because this time it was back to Wisconsin, mentioning Cole and Feingold, Cole being an open senator, but they actually said that Cole had turned the right way on their issue. And if anything, it fails because it's actually too positive about Cole, while also being negative about Democrats. So I think the facts, in those cases, the facts may become important, some of the facts would be more difficult to do this, unless you were just taking the overall idea that these things are just, this is a legitimate restriction.
That's all. I'm very intrigued by this idea of Buckley as Roe, from Roe versus Wade, from a stare decisis perspective, meaning we'll preserve the core of Buckley, like the court preserved the core of Roe and Casey, but at the same time as we do this, we'll overrule key precedents that were, you know, in the progeny of that prime precedent, in this case overruling Austin, maybe overruling McConnell. And I'd like, if you're at all interested in shifting from the predictive to the normative on this, and you can deflect it in the way that I deflected it on the Bush versus Gore this morning, but to me it's a very interesting normative question. If you do have a libertarian view
of this issue, where so you're a deregulationist, and you think Austin was wrong, and you think the Buckley on the contribution side was wrong, and disclosure is sufficient, or you're very close to that, the way Kennedy may be, why you would answer the stare decisis question one way in Austin and the other way on Buckley. Now, I heard some pragmatic reasons to do it, sort of, you know, the country has a stomach for it, or, you know, compromise or whatever. And that sounds all awfully a lot like O'Connor, maybe in Casey, but, you know, many people, I mean, is there a sort of a good normative account of why balancing your underlying view of the First Amendment issue against your stare decisis institutional view would yield that, as opposed to a much less robust theory that is just a good compromise?
I gather that's sort of aimed at me. I think that the way one would go about it, first would be Austin, I believe, as I indicated, is sort of the outlier. It's the old Sesame Street one that doesn't belong from the cases, at least prior to 19, well, at least prior to Shrinkback, I think, really. It's the case that kind of seems out of place in the Buckley heritage. So I think you could simply say, you know, you think Austin was wrong there. I mean, you're going to overrule it on the basis that it's the case that doesn't belong, correcting the prior error. Otherwise, I think that McConnell, I think, is exactly the kind of case that you talk about, that subverted much of Buckley while claiming to adhere to it. But the fact that it claims so much to adhere to Buckley gives the deregulationist on the court a way to just re-undermine it. Well, Buckley did say, you know, you could be concerned about contribution limits getting too low, and now we've got this opinion in Randall v. Sorrell that says the same, if they want to put a little upward pressure on limits there. And I think that might be how a court would do it, and at least feel that they had rationalized in a way that would fit, you know, I think you were one of them, maybe referred to Dworkin earlier today, you know, it fits the narrative of the whole and fits into the story and makes it work, and I think the judges might ultimately believe that. But I always thought, too, that I wish that Souter had taken this advantage to write a dissent. He wrote, you know, the dissent was a real long, kind of long and random historical. And basically what he should have just written in my book was, hey, what happened to Shrink Pack? And put nothing else. That would have been a great dissent.
Once again, I think I'm shocking myself. I agree very much with Brad. I think Austin is easy to overturn. It really is the case that doesn't. Well, McConnell builds on Austin. So that would also undo McConnell. The McConnell part of the lecture communications, Austin doesn't fit. It's a whole different one. If the only justification for restricting campaign activity is corruption, it uses a wildly different definition of corruption than the definition that's used elsewhere in the law. So that's an easy one. The other thing that is easy, in the sense it is a return to Buckley, of course, is the other piece of electionary communication, which is what constitutes election speech. Buckley took a really narrow definition, express advocacy. Now, that proved to be a useless definition, a toothless definition, one that is so easily avoidable that it was nonsense, and the court acknowledges it, privately acknowledge that. But you could, if you were talking about, because if the theme is back to Buckley, that's another one. The one I think is actually harder, and I think I'm hearing Brad alluding to it here, since we haven't actually talked about this straightforwardly, is the soft money restrictions, which is in some sense an expansion of Buckley, but this, for my money at least, is closer to the spirit of restricting large contributions which can have influence on candidates. It sort of attenuates what constitutes an unlawful influence, an improper influence. But I think that one is closer, we could debate, I'm sure we would debate that, closer to the idea of Buckley, which is the problem here is large money coming into the system, potentially to influence candidates. And Buckley said nothing about political parties. And I think there's an empirical debate as to what extent routing money from the party diffuses the corrupted possibilities. And how much do you have to show the linkage between a specific amount of money in a specific candidate or office holder. So there's some sense of what McConnell does is really relax the standards of proof. But I think that conceptually it's more akin to Buckley. Certainly both the expansion of the definition of regulatable speech and the application of corporations, those are bigger departures from Buckley, from my perspective, than the soft money conditions, which I think are closer.
Take our last question.
Yeah, just preliminarily, I agree with Richard, and I think, you know, the way you put it is quite right, that conceptually this question of the difference between election and general political speech, it's really hard. And you didn't put it quite this way. I think it's implicit in what you're saying. But if you think of the situation in which somebody wants to electioneer, not in general because I want to elect this candidate or that candidate, but because I want to use the election as a means to influence this issue. I mean, that is surely a sort of a basic activity in a democracy, and it's right on that line, and I think it's a baby that you can't cut. You can put it on one side of the line or the other, but you can't cut it. I wanted to make just a couple of points on the question of competitiveness and campaign spending. These are two very good papers, and if there's one thing that they really do differ on, it's probably the way they see Breyer's opinion with respect to that issue. And it occurs to me that one reason for that could be maybe we're talking about the same thing. You make the point that there's very little about freedom of speech in that opinion, but if we talked about a baseball game and we say, do we say the players want to pitch and hit and field, or do they want to compete? Well, the way they compete is by pitching and hitting and fielding, and when they're pitching and hitting and fielding, they're competing. And in the campaign context, speaking is campaigning. Speaking is competing. And so I think that, I don't know, but if I had to guess, my guess would be with Richard, that Breyer himself, at least, is probably doing this because he does, at least to some extent, go along with this structural idea, and he's doing it with a purpose. But I think that one can't necessarily distinguish or attribute that to other members of the court, because the two locutions can both be used in a fairly equivalent way. The other point is, it's related. I think Scalia in particular, I think, does a disservice to his side of the argument by emphasizing so strongly in some of his opinions the question of the incumbent advantage and the notion that the Congress or the legislatures are legislating to protect themselves against competition. Because ultimately, and I think Brad doesn't do that, or certainly doesn't do it nearly as much, because I think Brad would agree that really isn't the issue. The issue is freedom. The issue is freedom of speech. And that has to be balanced against the other concerns that justify campaign finance. But ultimately, it seems to me, we used to think that in a pretty straightforward way, that reducing the amount of money that could come into campaigns is going to benefit incumbents and going to hurt challengers, and that's why incumbents do it. Now I think we're not so sure about that. Maybe that's true, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's true in some situations and not others. But I think that ultimately these issues should not be decided on that basis. I mean, I think that, freedom of speech takes us so far in this direction, and the anti-corruption, and if you believe in it, anti-equality and various other concerns take us in the other direction, and then we resolve those. And it seems to me that if that tends to benefit incumbents, so be it, and if it tends to benefit challengers, so be it, because the constitutional issue is one of freedom of speech.
If you come at 8:30, you get some decent food. Great cook.
Rick?
Okay, thanks everybody.